Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Composers of color have long had to fight for a place in the classical canon and on the concert stage. In fact, many classical musicians and students at all levels are unaware of the wealth of music by black composers. A new project spearheaded by violinist Rachel Barton Pine seeks to correct that, especially as Tim Grieving reports for the next generation of music makers.
Growing up in Chicago, Rachel Barton Pine took it for granted that there was a great body of classical music by black composers. She heard it on the radio. She played it in local orchestras as a student. The Center for Black Music Research is in Chicago. So when she recorded her first concerto album in 1997, she naturally included music by Afro-Caribbean and Afro-European composers.
I wasn't thinking about any of the social justice aspect or anything like that. But after the record came out, I started getting a huge number of requests from students and parents and teachers about, you know, where can I find repertoire like this for kids of different levels?
So she began a nearly 20-year quest to catalog as much of this music as she could find. She had some time on her hands. 2 years earlier, she was caught in a closing Chicago train door and dragged 200 feet. She lost one leg and severely damaged the other and had more than 40 surgeries. But during the long recovery process, she devoted some of her spare time to searching for music.
You know, going to the Library of Congress and digging up the one copy of this and that, and going to the Haiti Music Archives in Montreal, going to the attic of the composer's grandniece to sort through unsorted boxes of papers and manuscripts. I mean, there have been some amazing archaeological adventures.
One of the pieces she found was a 1927 work called Levee Dance by the Tennessee-born composer Clarence Cameron White. It's one of the pieces that Pine has recorded for a new album called Blues Dialogues for violin and piano.
My parents would put on Chicago blues records when they weren't playing the classical station when I was growing up, and it's just sort of been in the air. I mean, I really consider it to be the music of, you know, of where I live.
One of the composers featured on that album, who also serves on the committee for Pine's new educational project, is Billy Childs, a Grammy-winning Los Angeles-based composer and pianist. Mm-hmm. Childs got a cold dose of how the classical establishment felt about composers of color when he went to the University of Southern California to study classical composition with a side of jazz performance.
And it seemed as though often I wouldn't be taken as seriously as a composer steeped in the European tradition of music because of my jazz background, but that also had kind of a racial overtone to it.
It's this attitude that violinist Rachel Barton Pine is trying to change with her Music by Black Composers project. She's working with the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia, the Dallas Symphony Young Strings Program, and Project STEP in Boston to introduce young musicians to composers and works that Billy Childs had to find himself.
Jesse Montgomery is a great composer, Valerie Coleman, Tanya Leon. You know, one of my favorite pieces ever written is by George Walker, and it's a trombone concerto.
All of these composers are part of Rachel Barton Pine's free online database, which includes more than 900 works by more than 350 composers from multiple continents. Pine's Music by Black Composers project has also published a new book for beginning violin students, the first in a series, as well as a coloring book and a timeline poster of around 300 composers.
I'm particularly excited to inspire African-American children so that they feel like they're part of classical music's history and future, but also to normalize diversity of repertoire for all students so that they grow up with this stuff and aren't satisfied with having concert experiences that don't reflect the totality of the human experience.
Composer Billy Childs is grateful for the Music by Black Composers project, but he also hopes it makes projects like this obsolete.
And the great wealth and the great legacy of music written by African American composers is not called Music by African American Composers, but called Music by Composers, so that we are looking at all music just like Duke Ellington said, good or bad.
And available. For NPR News, I'm Tim Grieving.
Shooby-doo, man. Get with it. You know, the oop to school. Now, these are people who are supposed to be intelligent. It's not a plan for finding uranium on the moon. We're not scientific at all.
Astrophysicist Dr. Jedidah Eisler has been focusing her studies on blazars. These are supermassive black holes in space. In tonight's brief but spectacular episode, she emphasizes diversity and inclusion in science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM.
I love space, period. Hands down, I think the night sky is one of the most beautiful things in the universe. Learning about space was sort of the thing that I did when I was a kid. And then I found black holes, and life was different. That's now my area of expertise. I study black holes. I study supermassive black holes, the ones that are like millions to billions of times the mass of our own sun. And they are marvelous. They have a way of forming very, very fast-moving jets very near them. And I think that the way the universe is able to be a particle accelerator, I think that's really amazing. When I say to people, I'm an astrophysicist, I can tell the extent to which they're surprised by that, by their response to me. You're an astrophysicist? When I was sort of earlier coming up, I felt uncomfortable about that. Like, I felt like I should apologize that I do astrophysics, but now it's something that I sort of like to stand into. Yes, let's feel what it feels like to talk to a black woman astrophysicist. It's awesome. I was probably 8 or 9 when I started realizing that I love this guy. I was 12 when I found out that you could do something called astrophysics. And I marched all along just knowing I wanted to do it and had support from my family and my friends. And it wasn't until I got later on in my career, high school, college, graduate school, where it became obvious to me that there weren't very many people who looked like me, that is a black woman, interested in astrophysics that I knew. But when I graduated from Yale with my PhD in astrophysics, studying these blazars, which you all should study, when I did that, I unwittingly became the first black woman to do so. There are so many barriers that still remain in the way of students access and achievement. And for me, I pushed through, I let my passion lead, and I said, I'm going to do astrophysics no matter what, but I want to make sure that the next person doesn't have to make that same choice. That any person from any background, whether marginalized or not, can say, I love astrophysics and I want to do this thing. My main intervention right now is an online web series called Vanguard STEM. And the idea is that going through this experience, being a black woman in astrophysics is unique. And so there are different challenges, there are different goals, all kinds of wins and losses that I go through just being in this body doing this work. And I want to make sure that we're having conversation around that. I want to make sure that the support and culture and community is there to support one another, because often we're one or a few in any individual location, but we're actually pretty numerous across the country and across the world. So the goal of Vanguard STEM is to bring women of color in particular together once a month, have conversations about mental health, about being free, about being healthy as they're pursuing their STEM interests and identities. My name is Dr. Jedidah Eisler, and this is my brief but spectacular take on astrophysics and inclusion in STEM.
Why haven't you learned anything?
Sometimes people have a profound impact on our lives, shifting its trajectory. This story in our ongoing Misconnection series begins at Southridge High School in Beaverton, Oregon.
So when I was in high school, the police officer that was stationed in my school would oftentimes sort of call me and a lot of my friends out of class into his office.
Greg McElvey was a junior. Andrew Halbert was the school resource officer, the police department's representative to Southridge High.
At the school, there was a rather rampant theft issue. Anything that was easily picked up, so like a graphing calculator, iPod, iPhone, any sort of small electronic that was easy to take. It was a group of probably 4 to 5 people that were consistently being implicated in thefts.
They thought that it was this group of friends that I had. It was a predominantly white school.
Greg McElvey is black. He says the few black students at Southridge hung out together.
And so in that group, they thought that we were responsible for the calculators that were going missing, and they viewed me as sort of the leader of that group. And so I think that led them to want to find out if I knew where the calculator was, or multiple calculators.
Andrew Halbert followed his leads in addition to his other duties.
Selfishly, I would rather be doing outreach and education than taking theft reports, but I was also getting pressure from the school and parents who were the victims of these thefts to actually start doing something about this. So I started a broader investigation and just started collecting information.
An investigation that Halbert says included interviews, digital forensics, and culminated in a search warrant for Greg McElvey's home.
The next thing I know, they're barging through the door in riot gear, and my grandma comes to the door, and from there, they just go through my entire room looking for my laptop so that they could try and get information about calculators.
This all happened in 2010. Greg McElvey went on to law school and became active in the Black Lives Matter movement. He first told this story on Twitter as part of a local government debate about having police officers in schools. He wanted to illustrate how they are not always a reassuring presence, particularly to students of color.
I knew I wasn't a criminal, but that's all I knew. And so it was really scary. And sort of it changes the whole way that you go through high school when you're afraid that you might get pulled out of class at any given time because of a police officer. And it changes the attitude of the students around you when they know that you're constantly being talked to by the police officers. It makes it hard to do homework when you think that police officers might come into your home. So it really impacts, I think, every part of your high school life in a way that I think most people, including probably the officers, don't really think about.
Andrew Halbert is now no longer a police officer. Shortly after this incident, he also went on to law school. The men agreed to meet on air, where they still see what happened at the end of that school year 8 years ago in very different ways. Halbert says Greg McElvey's tweets caught him off guard.
I was surprised because I've been out of law enforcement for some time. My opinion, and you have to understand that this is now a decade removed, I always think that the conversation should be ongoing, and it needs to be a conversation. The analogy that I've used is we used to have the DARE program, and that was found to be largely ineffective. And so it's important to look and evaluate at what is being done. I still think that the value of a school resource officer is incredibly important. I think in many cases, it's an opportunity to bridge the gap between the quote unquote scary police officer that you see driving around and try and find ways for conversations to be had about what are the realities of police work and conversely, what are the realities that these students experience with law enforcement in their own communities.
So, Greg, speaking with Andrew, he detailed to us a very thorough investigation that he undertook that had to do with witnesses and sort of digital evidence and all sorts of things, and that it took quite a long time, over a year. It wasn't sort of a haphazard thing. And is there something perhaps in your perceptions that you think may be different had you known the circumstances around what happened?
No, I don't think that changes it. I think that when you have Black students being afraid that, you know, multiple officers are going to come through their door, they're going to be pulled out of class or arrested at track practice, and you have white students that are afraid that maybe they might get detention, I think that that discrepancy is worth talking about. And then just on the note of having officers in school so that they can bridge the gap in the community, I mean, no other profession is awarded that. I don't see why officers are there to do that. If officers were in the community not doing the scary police officer things, then there would be no reason to have to bridge that gap.
Andrew, watching the news and seeing how cops are more likely to view Black boys as a threat and the statistics that show that they are treated differently, was that something apparent to you when you worked as a school resource officer? Was that something that they had trained you for?
No, I mean, there wasn't any specific training for that. I mean, our department as a whole, they put a tremendous value on treating all people equally. They took a lot of steps and made efforts to track statistics for the race classification that we had contact with to help make sure that officers are not making decisions based off race, because that is clearly something that should not happen.
Obviously, this is a conversation that we're having right now, but it is a wider conversation taking place in America about policing, about how we treat people who are different to us, how we do our jobs when we have, all of us, biases that we feel. So I'm curious to know, first of all, from you, Andrew, looking back, would you have done something differently, maybe, knowing what you know? I know you've left law enforcement, but would you have done something differently?
I feel comfortable in my decision-making. But again, I would always hope that the formal adjudication or formal criminal path is not the number one option to use. And so my hope would have been that an earlier intervention could have had a more positive outcome.
Greg, this changed your life. You're now an activist. Was this an experience that was formative for you?
I think it was. I think also specifically we're talking about that sort of dialogue in the beginning. I mean, never once did I think that Officer Halbert was just some racist white cop, you know, that was just out to get Black kids. But when we're having this conversation about equity and treating everybody equal, I think that we're not talking about the inherent biases that all of us hold. It's not necessarily why would you do this investigation, but what were better ways to do it? Like, could it be better if the Black kids were getting detention or, you know, a talking to by the vice principal the same way as white kids in these white majority schools are?
And your perspectives on this event are still different. Would you say that, Andrew?
Yes, I would say that's correct.
Greg?
I think that there's context that both of us are missing on either side, but I don't think that there's any disagreement on the impact that this would have on me or on students that experience similar things throughout the country.
Would you have contact with each other after this, do you think?
Yeah, I'd be willing to.
I'm happy if the producer shares my email address with him if he wants to ask more questions about this incident or, you know, my perspective during my time as a police officer. I think I understand Greg went to law school as well, so I think we have some similarities where we can discuss from a legal perspective, but absolutely, if he has questions, he can get in touch with me.
All right, we will do that. Thank you again very much.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Greg McKelvey says he was never charged with stealing calculators, and he says he wasn't involved in the thefts. Andrew Halpert says he passed the case on to his successor, and he doesn't know how or if a culprit was found. He first told this story on Twitter as part of a local government debate about having police officers in schools. He wanted to illustrate how they are not always a reassuring presence, particularly to students of color.
This is KNKX. There's been a lot of debate nationally and locally about how to prevent school shootings like the one that left 17 people dead in Florida last February. A Republican state representative from Aberdeen says one important prevention tool is to provide armed school resource officers in schools. More from KNKX Youth and Education reporter Ashley Gross.
Representative Jim Walsh has pre-filed a bill that would authorize funding from the state to pay for one school resource officer in each public school. Providing more school resource officers was one of the recommendations from the Washington Mass Shootings Work Group. Walsh says this is a practical step to make schools more secure.
We need to make them safer. You know, there's nothing worse than having our public schools soft targets.
Walsh says this would cost about $190 million a year and that the state could afford it without raising taxes. But teachers and students have spoken out against adding armed officers to school campuses, and the ACLU of Washington says there's a dearth of evidence that they prevent school shootings. Ashley Gross, KNKX News.
That cool, refreshing drink.
A little more than a decade ago, the city of Juneau, Alaska, became one of many American cities that stopped adding fluoride to its tap water. At the time, science predicted more cavities. That prediction has now proven true. From member station KTOO, Jeremy Shea reports.
Jennifer Meyer is a public health researcher with a new study in the journal BMC Oral Health. She talks about tooth decay and cavities the way dentists do. She calls them caries. And after studying what happened in Juneau to children under six, this is her takeaway.
By taking the fluoride out of the water supply, the trade-off for that is children are going to experience one additional caries procedure per year, at a ballpark of $300 more per child.
She can talk about it in terms of money because she studied the complete set of Medicaid dental claims filed for kids in Juneau's main zip code. She's got a year's worth of data before fluoride went away and another year's worth after for about 1,900 kids total. When you talk about children under six, here's what happened. When the water was still fluoridated, kids on average had about 1.5 cavity-related procedures per year. After fluoride was gone, that went up to about 2.5 procedures a year, and that got expensive.
The cost to have a fluoride management program to actually fluoridate the water is pennies by comparison to what it costs to treat a cavity.
It could be more expensive for anyone, not just the public cost of providing dental care through Medicaid. But Meyer says people with less money are especially vulnerable when fluoride goes away. For example, people with more resources might choose to give their kids fluoride tablets. That would mitigate the absence of fluoride in the water supply for those children. The new research isn't winning over longtime fluoride opponents like David Hamm. He was active in the movement to take fluoride out of Juneau's water in 2006. He calls fluoridation a Band-Aid fix.
My issue is that we're asking the wrong question here, you know, and let's get to the root cause and put a tax on sugary drinks and all of these other things or do whatever we can to support good health through good diet.
Hamm says community water fluoridation takes away his right to pure water. He also says fluoride is harmful. But the CDC, World Health Organization, European Union, and other government and medical institutions have long held that low levels of fluoride in drinking water are safe. For NPR News, I'm Jeremy Shea in Juneau.
Mama says police misshoot black people.
Moving on, as of January 1st, more police records are now available to the public in California. That's because of new state laws going into effect this year. Until now, California had a reputation for being one of the most secretive states in the nation when it comes to police conduct. To talk about what changes, we brought in KPCC's senior investigative reporter Annie Gilbertson. Hi, Annie.
Hi, Megan.
So, Annie, explain the new laws, because it is laws, plural, right?
Yeah, there are two. So one has to do with police personnel records and investigations, and this is already in effect as of January 1. So we should be able to get records of sustained findings of law enforcement that were found to be lying or to have committed sexual assault. These records had been secret from the public before. Mm-hmm. We should also be able to see investigations into use of force that created great bodily injury or any of the shooting investigations. And I had requested many of those types of records before and been denied many times. Mm-hmm. So this is certainly a change. The second law that should be on everybody's mind is it actually goes into effect in July, so not quite yet, but it's going to open up a lot of video involved in these incidents. So camera, video, audio recordings of officer shootings, other serious use of force incidents, they should be made available to the public within 45 days. That is, unless there is, it would interfere with an investigation or with a criminal proceeding. But that's certainly a totally different tune than what we've seen in the past in California.
Right. So, I mean, do you think that these laws will make a difference in kind of bringing California police conduct out of the dark?
Yeah. Will it ultimately bring conduct out of the dark? We will see how agencies respond to our many requests. You know, California has long been known as one of the most secretive states in the nation when it comes to police conduct. So I'll just give you an example of video. Like, we've seen so much police shooting videos from around the country in the last few years, but very little of it from California. And that's because police departments had the option of whether or not they wanted to release video. And what I saw as a reporter is they would release the video when it looked good and made them look good to the public. Mm-hmm. And they would withhold video when there was a lot more scrutiny around the shootings. So it really begs this question of how are officers being held accountable? And that's a question that I've been exploring, as you know, Megan, for a couple of years now with the Repeat podcast, where we looked at a string of officer shootings in South LA. This officer shot at 4 people in 7 months, which is a very short period of time to be in that many shootings. And on paper, from what we could see in the public, you know, these were written off as legally justified shootings. That is what the adjudication proceedings had found. But we wondered if there wasn't more to the story there. And ultimately, what we found was this police accountability system that is completely kept in the dark, that is shrouded from the public's view. So oftentimes, there is a panel of top law enforcement that looks at these use of force incidents, that adjudicates what happens, decides whether or not an officer should go back out into the field. And all of those findings are held secret from the public, or were.
Now, there's obviously been a lot of national attention to police shootings in recent years, particularly those of unarmed Black men, really sparking the entire Black Lives Matter movement. Do you think these new laws show that protests are working?
Oh, I mean, undeniably, that conversation has really elevated the discussion throughout the couple of years. I mean, starting with Michael Brown, I think that's what many people look back to as the pivotal moment where people started questioning what was happening with police shootings. I mean, I will make a distinction that these are laws that are making public records more available. These are not laws that are going to necessarily decrease shootings. There was a law like that that was proposed, a piece of legislation in Sacramento last year that did not pass. That would have said, you know, look, officers should only shoot when absolutely necessary. It did not pass. Only these open records laws, which I think the open records law get at another important issue that has been raised to the surface with these protests that you mentioned, which is sort of this undercurrent that, do we trust that law enforcement is properly holding their own accountable when it's done so in secret? So the analogy I like to make is from the Rodney King beating, right? So that video got released. That is not what sparked the protest. What sparked the protest was when the officers were acquitted. And so it offended people's sense of justice. And I think that right now the country is asking, you know, are officers being reasonably held accountable for these use of force? And in California, we couldn't even look deeply at these cases because the records were sealed.
So have you been making use of these laws yet in service of your journalism?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, I started with a list of records requests that I wanted to make January 1. I set a timer for my emails to go out 12 a.m. just right at the new year. And it was too long. My records list was way too long. It was like over 60 different requests. So I tried to narrow it down, definitely trying to be more focused and surgical in what exactly we're asking for. Because frankly, I need to also sleep in 2019. I cannot just read records request. So we had to narrow that way down. But we have certainly asked for some stuff. Looking back at the podcast and what we couldn't get last year, mm-hmm. we're asking for.
And there's already been a challenge to one of these laws, right?
Yeah, law enforcement did not like this legislation when it was in Sacramento. They said, look, this is going to infringe on an officer's right to privacy. We don't want these cases being tried out there in the media. And then even after the law passed, we saw some pushback from the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Union, the deputies union out there, who filed in court. They said, hey, we need to decide whether or not this law should be retroactive, whether you should be able to access case files that go back further than the start date of the law, which was January 1. So we did just recently learn that that petition to block the opening of records has been denied. So it sounds like we're going forward as written.
Hopefully this aids in your work. How do you think this will benefit the public?
Well, I think in general, in the most idealistic sense, we like to think that better facts, better information will lead to a more nuanced understanding of the truth, of what's really happening. I mean, that's like a journalistic principle, right? And in law enforcement, civil rights advocates and the like say that these types of facts being drawn out will lead to better policy, because if law enforcement is more aware or more accountable to officers that have lied or have repeatedly used force, we may see better decision-making in departments. But I got to tell you, Megan, sometimes there are agencies that are aware of problems that do not act upon the problem. So we will see how, if that idealism plays out. I mean, there could be also very tangible effects for different people. So if we learn more about, say, a case in which an officer was found to have been lying again and again or filed a false police report, I mean, we could see convictions overturned, right? And that could be a very real effect on justice and what we know is true and what we know is not true.
All right, KPCC investigative journalist Annie Gilbertson, thanks.
Thank you.
I want to be a cop. Can you keep your lips sealed? I think with leadership skills can turn low-level offenders into crisp bills. You know, I've always wanted to be a cop.
Local police now have access to a firearms forensic tool that is managed by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. But defense attorneys are pushing back against evidence they say is not scientific. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Jonathan Levinson reports.
Portland police officer Jason Hubert is test firing a handgun at the department's North Precinct. Officers recently took it from a suspect. He then places the casings under a microscope. He's about to enter the shell casing into the National Integrated Ballistics Information Network, or NIBIN, a nationwide database of high-resolution images of shell casings started by the ATF in 1999. Hubert fires two rounds into a large trap filled with a thick sludge.
I'm looking for a good ejector mark.
That's the mark left on the casing as it's expelled from the gun. He'll pick one to go into NIBIN.
And the ejector mark is basically the fingerprint of this shell casing.
At the Portland Police Department, this is all new. Until last July, these casings had to be sent to a crime lab. Results would take months to get back. And they were only used by firearms examiners to testify at trial.
That's of no help in investigators' use of that technology to try to figure out who shot the gun.
Assistant U.S. Attorney for the District of Oregon, Suzanne Hayden, helped get the NIBIN system into police departments so they could be used in local investigations.
Each firearm that shoots a bullet leaves an imprint that's unique to that firearm.
So the idea is, find a casing that matches in NIBIN, and police may be able to connect multiple shootings and make arrests before the gun is used again. But the argument that the imprint is unique? That's a sticking point. Janice Purikal is an attorney and the founder of the Oregon-based Forensics Justice Project.
The problem is that no one's gone out and actually determined that it could only be matched to that gun to the exclusion of all other guns in the universe.
Flawed firearms forensics have led to exonerations. In 2013, a Mississippi man's life was spared hours before his scheduled execution after the FBI said experts had overstated the science. In a letter to the district attorney in that case, the Bureau said examiners may only testify to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty. Department of Justice guidelines say examiners may only offer an expert opinion. But the opinions that form during an investigation, Purikal says they can be problematic too.
It's the idea that once we start building that narrative and it starts making sense, the more things that we see that fit into that same narrative.
Almost 200 agencies own NIBIN terminals and are using the data as an investigative tool. On a recent night in Portland, Sergeant Stephen Wilbon has his eye on a car parked down the street from Jefferson High School. He pulls up and talks to the three people inside about the homecoming game that's just getting out.
Who won?
Jefferson?
He drives off and runs the plates.
All right.
The computer tells him it's been reported stolen.
Stolen car.
Officers approach the car from both sides.
Do you have a valid concealed carry permit?
Well, I know you're saying it's not your gun, but...
Yeah, it's in the back of this car.
Okay.
In his waistband, or it's in his pocket. There's no denying it, so...
Wilbon says they found three loaded guns inside, without the permits required in Oregon, and two of the people had outstanding warrants. Because the Portland police have this new equipment, the casings were immediately entered into NIBIN. Seattle police use it too, and the ATF database indicated a match to shootings there. A police department spokesperson in Seattle says it was a lead that moved their case forward, which is exactly how the Department of Justice intends for NIBIN to be used. For NPR News, I'm Jonathan Levinson in Portland.
That story comes to us from Guns and America, a public media reporting project on the role of guns in American life.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on black Americans from colonial times to the present.
There's a recent study out of Oregon that shows that race comes into play even when it means administering life-saving care. Specifically, this study shows black patients are 40% less likely to get pain medication than white people. Christian Fodenfinsel of Oregon Public Broadcasting reports.
Differences in how races are treated by doctors and the ER are well documented. Whites tend to get better care and have healthier outcomes. But until this study, it was unclear if the same was happening in an emergency, in the back of an ambulance. Leslie Gregory always wondered. Now a physician assistant, Gregory got her start as one of a very few black female EMTs. She remembers one call. The patient was down and in pain. Driving up, she could see he was black. Then one of her colleagues groaned.
It was something like, oh God, here we go again.
She worried her colleague thought that because he was black, he was acting out to get pain meds.
At the time, I remember it increased my stress as we rode up on this person because I thought, now am I going to have to fight my colleague for more pain medication should that arise?
A group of researchers at Oregon Health and Science University decided to try to see if there was a difference in the way patients were treated on emergency calls. They looked at 100,000 medical charts of ambulance patients over 3 years. Black patients were less likely to receive pain medications compared to white patients, regardless of socioeconomic factors like health insurance. At the end of a recent shift at American Medical Response in Portland, a row of ambulances files into the garage. Many emergency responders here bristle at the idea race plays a role in care. Jennifer Sanders has been a paramedic for 30 years.
I've never treated anybody different, regardless.
The very idea is distasteful, says paramedic Jason Dahlke.
No one I work with will explicitly and intentionally discriminate against somebody. It's not what we do. It's not the business that we're in.
But Dahlke is willing to entertain the idea unconscious bias is at work in his field.
Historically, it's the way this country has been. In the beginning, we had slavery and then Jim Crow and then redlining and all of this stuff that you can get lost in like a large macro scale. Yeah, it's there.
So this study has given him pause. He mentions an older black patient he just treated. He was diabetic and complaining of extreme pain. Dahlke gave him glucose for low blood sugar, but no pain meds. He says that's because by the time he'd stabilized his blood sugar, they'd reached the hospital. And would he have done anything differently if the patient had been white?
Consciously, absolutely not. Unconsciously, that's what studies are saying.
Dahlke thinks another issue at play may be that white patients are more comfortable asking for medications than patients of color. Former EMT Leslie Gregory agrees. She says after years of discrimination, many African Americans have their own biases about the medical system, and they just don't trust it.
How can a person of color not disrespect a system that is constantly studying and talking about these disparities, but does nothing to fix it?
The author of this new ambulance study, Jamie Kennell, says another reason disparities loom so large may be that EMTs work in a stressful and time-pressured environment.
In these situations, providers are much more likely to default to making decisions based on stereotypes.
So, now ambulance agencies know unconscious bias may be at work. What are they doing about it? Robert McDonald with American Medical Response says he's looking at new training and a change in hiring practices.
We want to see more ethnicities represented in EMS that has historically been a white, male-dominated workforce.
The first step, though, is for emergency workers to just be aware of the role bias may play in care. For NPR News, I'm Christian Fodenwenzel in Portland.
This story is part of a partnership with NPR, Oregon Public Broadcasting, and Kaiser Health News.
Now, it doesn't matter now. It really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, "We are sorry for the delay. But we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane. And to be sure that all of the bags were checked. And to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully. And we've had the plane protected and guarded all night. And then I got into Memphis. And some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out. Or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers."
A loose cannon and a white traitor. Those are just a couple of the things our next guest has been called, according to his own official bio on the Jackson Clarion Ledger website. Jerry Mitchell is a reporter for the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi. He has spent his career investigating some of the most notorious killings of the civil rights era. Mitchell's work has led to the arrest and conviction of the people responsible for the assassination of NAACP leader Medgar Evers, the 1963 bombing of a Birmingham, Alabama church that killed four girls, and the man who organized the killings of three civil rights workers. Now, after more than 30 years at the paper, Mitchell is leaving to start a new independent journalism project. Jerry Mitchell joins us from Jackson. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
So it was 1989 when you took up investigating the civil rights era and killings from that era that had gone unpunished. And I want to ask about what I gather was the very first case you took on, which was the assassination of Medgar Evers. Remind people who he was.
Well, Medgar Evers was NAACP leader. He was the field secretary for the Mississippi NAACP. He fought in Normandy and then came home and fought racism all over again in the form of Jim Crow, put like 50, 60,000 miles a year on his Oldsmobile, driving across Mississippi investigating civil rights beatings and killings. And he, on the same night that President Kennedy told the nation that the grandsons of slaves were still not free, he was assassinated, shot in the back outside his own home. Huh. June 12, 1963.
1963. Now, the following year, 1964, a former KKK member, this is Byron Dulla Beckwith, he was tried for this crime. He was actually tried twice for it, hung jury both times. How did you end up circling back to this in 1989?
If you're like me, if someone tells me I can't have something, I want it a million times worse. And so there was something called the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission. It had more than 132,000 pages of spy records that were sealed for 50 years by the Mississippi legislature.
Explain just briefly, what is the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission?
The Sovereignty Commission was had kind of a spy arm. They would infiltrate civil rights groups, report back.
This was a state, a government organization?
Yes. It was headed by the governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state. I mean, every major official in Mississippi was a part of the Sovereignty Commission. So I was able to develop sources who had access to these secret files, began to leak me these files. What they showed at the same time, the state of Mississippi was prosecuting Byron Dulla Beckwith for the killing of Medgar Evers. This other arm of the state, the Sovereignty Commission, was secretly assisting in defense, trying to get Beckwith acquitted. And nobody knew that. And that story ran October 1st, 1989. And led to the reopening of the case and eventually the re-prosecution.
And led to a new trial, and Dulla Beckwith was convicted.
Yes.
Another case, Sam Bowers.
Yes.
The imperial wizard for the Klan in Mississippi. And you spent years trying to prove that he was behind the assassination of another NAACP activist.
Yes.
Vernon Damer. What happened with that?
Well, Vernon Damer was NAACP leader, businessman. He basically died defending his family. The Klan firebombed his house began firing their guns in the house. He grabbed his shotgun, ran to the front of the house, began firing at the Klansmen so his family could escape safely out a back window. But unfortunately, the fire seared his lungs, and he died later that day. And Bowers ordered that. And so I tracked down the key witness in the case, whose name was Billy Roy Pitts. He was stunned when I found him. I found him just through the internet, believe it or not. And Mississippi authorities issued a warrant for his arrest. And so he ran. And while he was on the run, he sent me a cassette tape. And on it, he recorded a message. And this is what he said: "Jerry, I just thought I'd let you know you've ruined my life. But I promise if I talk to anybody, I'd talk to you. So here's this tape." And on this tape, he proceeds to tell me all about his involvement in killing Vernon Dahmer, all about his involvement in all this other Klan violence. And
wow, the full confession on tape.
Full confession on tape.
Mailed to you in the newsroom? Or how'd you
mailed
get it?
To me in the newsroom. Yeah, that's how I got it in the newsroom. I did a story, obviously, and he turned himself shortly after this into authorities, and this led to Sam Bowers' arrest and his trial as well.
And he was ultimately convicted, too.
Convicted August 21st, 1998, and sentenced to life in prison.
I love that you still remember the exact date of that. It meant something to you.
I'm a journalist. I have to remember dates, right?
Why has it been so important to you to pursue these stories, these prosecutions, as they ended up being, so long, decades after the fact?
Well, it was important to me. It just kind of stuck in my craw, these guys getting away with murder. And I think what made these cases unique, in a sense, it was not just these guys got away with murder. It was the fact that everybody knew they got away with murder. So this was kind of injustice at its height.
I mean, where do you think Mississippi, and I guess the South more broadly, are in wrestling with the legacy of the civil rights movement and some of the really awful violence that played out alongside it?
I don't know that the South has completely come to terms with it. I think you're starting to begin to see this. Mississippi now has built a civil rights museum, and that's a sign, I think, a real good step. So that people can begin to learn. I can't tell you how much people, when I talk to them about things that happened in the civil rights movement, will say, "I never knew that." They didn't teach me that in school, or whatever it is. So I think there's a lot of ignorance or lack of knowledge about the movement.
It's something that just wasn't talked about in the Deep South. It was uncomfortable.
Absolutely. When I first started writing these stories, I mean, I would have people call and just cuss me out all the time, death threats and things like that. But those began to wane, for the most part, wane over time. I still got the death threats, but I think there's some change, especially with the new generation coming up. I sense with them that they're kind of tired of the things that Mississippi's been labeled with or perceived as, and they really want to change that.
I'm thinking about the kind of reporting you have done, so much of which rests on establishing a set of common facts. And I wonder, is it harder in this era of fake news and alternative facts in which we live?
Well, you know, I guess it is. There was always a struggle even before because, you know, the Klan would kind of put out their version of what they claimed happened. And of course, it wasn't true at all. And to try to conceal their crimes and things like that. But I think truth is truth. I think that it's a good thing. And I think that's one of the things I think that's great about reporting is we seek the truth and we seek to shine a light on those things. And I've always been of the opinion whenever you shine a light that, you know, the cockroaches kind of scatter. So I've always been a fan of that.
Jerry Mitchell, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Jerry Mitchell, an investigative journalist these last 30 years at the Jackson Clarion Ledger. He jumps this week to the Mississippi Center for Investigative Reporting. The human element.
Hot set. Put it on him. Free Mumia. Mumia Abu-Jamal has always maintained his innocence in the 1981 fatal shooting of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. His prosecution was politically motivated, he has always maintained, because of his Black Panther Party membership, his support of the MOVE organization, and as a radical and activist journalist. In 1982, his trial then, he was
essentially treated to all kinds of bias in terms of his initial prosecution and his appeal. But there apparently is some new information, and a judge recently found that Mumia Abu-Jamal's claim of a unconstitutional bias against him was, in fact, a real and substantial claim. Joining us to talk about it is somebody who's worked as a co-counsel on this case for quite a bit of time, Rachel Walker. And we are delighted to have you back, and we're delighted to hear that there seems to be some positive movement. Happy New Year. Please remind people who Mumia Abu-Jamal is and why we should care. We've got a lot of younger people who might not know much of this history.
That's great. Thank you very much, Dennis, for having me on here. And I think 2019 is going to be a very important year for Mumia, for his fight for freedom. And with that, as I'll get into a little bit, is also basically a fight against the entire criminal and justice system in this country. And a victory for him and walking out of prison is actually going to be a victory for all of us against the type of racial and class bias that exists in this country. So just to continue with some of the things you said about Mumia, he was, when he was 16 years old and in Philadelphia, he was targeted by the FBI and the Philadelphia police because he was a Black Panther Party spokesman and put him on basically a terrorist watch list to put him into a concentration camp, quite literally, if in fact there was some, you know, civil unrest in the country. And he went on to basically become a radical journalist after some years in the Black Panther Party, and very renowned for his most beautiful, beautiful voice and his radio voice and his very insightful interviews that he did of, you know, on police brutality, on social questions, poverty, interviewed Julius Erving and Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee and all sorts of people. And I think he got an award actually when he covered a trip by the Pope to Philadelphia even.
Yeah, so he was a contributor to public radio, NPR as well.
Yes, mm-hmm. he was, mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. My apologies for forgetting to say that. So then he also became, as a journalist, he became a supporter of the MOVE organization. He started as telling, quote, the truth about them, as opposed to the type of bias and slander and harassment that the MOVE organization got from the Philadelphia police. He grew dreadlocks. He considered himself a MOVE supporter, and as he became more of a supporter with them, he was really shut out of public radio and any sort of radio in Philadelphia. And from that point on, he basically was known mostly as a political person. This murder of this police officer happened in December of 1981. Mumia has always maintained his innocence. I was co-counsel, as you indicated, from 1994 really to 1999. I was in charge of the investigation that we did during that time. And from all of the evidence, not only Mumia's assertion of his innocence, and I first started working with Mumia back in 1987, that basically none of the evidence of Mumia's so-called, you know, his participation in this murder holds up in the face of any sort of examination. He was quite literally framed. The ballistics is phony that they presented. The witnesses were threatened, coerced, or given promises. There was one witness that supposedly identified him. And also they said he made a confession in the hospital after he was shot on the street, beaten viciously by the police officers there and arriving. And we can go on from there. His trial was run by the notorious Judge Albert Szabo, known as the King of Death Row. He put more people on death row than any other judge in the entire country, pro-prosecution. And many years later, in 2002, we learned that from a court stenographer who overheard him tell another judge that he was going to help fry help them fry the inn.
Nigger!
And we didn't learn that till then. So Mumias had four levels and different levels of appeals after his appeal of his conviction and death penalty. And with all this evidence of police, prosecutorial, and judicial misconduct, deprivation of all rights of due process in a trial, everything from excluding blacks from his jury, denying him the right to represent himself, denying him the right to effective counsel, and, you know, really like a dozen other legal issues that are all involved in Mumia's case. So we had all these appeals over all these years. Mumia was shut down by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which has become the issue here. He got off of death row only after many levels of appeals, in which the federal court judge in 2001 found that his sentence of death was unconstitutional because of Judge Szabo, the very same judge I mentioned before, giving improper instructions to the jury. Even though his death sentence was reversed, he was kept in death row in solitary confinement, which means being kept in a little cell, which Mumi always described like being in a toilet, you know, a small toilet. And he had to stay there for 10 years while his the overturning of his death sentence was appealed by the prosecution twice up to the U.S. Supreme Court. The decision of the district court judge stood, and Mumia was taken off of death row and out of solitary confinement and was sentenced to life without parole. And in Pennsylvania, life without parole means exactly that. You do not get out of prison until you are carried out feet first. So he has been there in general population. He got very sick in the prison. He's still recovering, or barely recovering, from the effects of untreated hepatitis C, which seems that quite clearly that he got from the blood transfusion he got on that night in December 81 when he was critically wounded. I could go on and on. As you
well, let me just jump in here.
Let's go to the point.
There's one other point I want you to speak to so that people understand the context. We're talking about Philadelphia with the most, as Mumia was coming up and reporting on it, the most corrupt police department in the country by far, a police department that was willing to drop bombs on suburban houses. This is a police force that was time and again singled out by the Justice Department in federal investigations of being floored in every way, shape, and form in terms of the delivery of justice for people of color. Would that be a proper statement of the situation?
Absolutely proper. And some of this goes around just the general viciousness of the Philadelphia police, which was for many years headed by Frank Rizzo, who set up his own version of investigative, or actually repressive, surveillance measures and hostility to activists, as well as, of course, beginning with the black community in Philadelphia. He carried a club in his, even in when he got dressed up to go to fancy places, and basically was just very extremely vicious. And the policies that he had were actually copied by Hoover in a lot of ways when dealing with the questions of black activism and also any sort of political protest. This was the years of the Vietnam War, the civil rights movement, murder of Martin Luther King. All those things were going on during this initial period of time when Mumia was a teenager, and that's part of the history there. When in 1978, Rizzo did a year-long blockade of the area where the MOVE organization lived, right near the University of Pennsylvania. And at the end of that that year blockade, was really of the neighborhood as well, and Mumia covered this, which is when he got to be very well known by the police. He was known by the police. Let me say this again. Mumia was known by the police when he was 16 years old, and from the time he was 16 years old to when he was arrested for this murder he did not commit was only 10 years. For younger people, 10 years may seem a long time, but if you're a cop on the street there and you've known this kid being out there speaking as a youngster about the murder of Fred Hampton, and you know, from the pulpit in churches in Philadelphia, and you know him in that way, and then you hear his voice over radio, and he's renowned and loved throughout the entire black community, you know exactly who Mumia Abu-Jamal is. In any event, the cops went after the MOVE house, the MOVE commune in 78. They water hosed it. They shot fire. They shot into it. They basically tried to drown the people, who included children, who were in the house. When people came out of the house, they attacked people, and in particular Delbert Africa. And before you had Rodney King being televised, being beaten by the cops, there was Delbert Africa being beaten by the cops. And the whole history, as you mentioned, of police brutality, corruption, and everything that was going on in the city, sort of heightened by this televised beating of Delbert Africa, led, in fact, the U.S. Justice Department to start the first ever action against the Philadelphia Police Department to put them into receivership. Now, that only lasted for about 2 months.
They also firebombed a house, the MOVE house,
okay,
right?
Okay, that goes to 85.
Yeah, oh, I see. Okay.
So, basically, this is all the precursor.
That's unbelievable. Go on.
Faulkner's,
I'm sorry.
That's okay, of Faulkner's murder. And there was also all the level of corruption in the city. So at the time that Faulkner was killed, there were four investigations going on by the FBI into police corruption and mob corruption. It's the time of mob wars going on in Philadelphia. And they learned at that time that, in fact, there was a connection. They supposedly were surprised to learn that, between cops and the mob. And the Faulkner who was killed, there's very substantial reason to believe he was an informant on behalf of the FBI against the police corruption going on. Not that Faulkner was known as a good guy. I mean, he was racist, and that's what all the reports were, but that's neither here nor there. In any event, all these things are going on when this murder happens of the police officer, that Mumia was not responsible at all for. Evidence supports that Mumia was shot not by the police officer, as the prosecution said, but by another police officer on the scene. All of this is a whole other story. But to go to what you're saying, well, Mumia was already arrested in prison, and the people who from the 78 attack on MOVE in 78, the MOVE 9, were all away in prison. That was some of the leadership of the MOVE organization. And what happened in 1985 is there was an attempt to say that there were problems in the neighborhood with MOVE, you know, speaking out loud and having fresh, you know, food and dogs and things like that. In any event, what they did, a combination of using federal explosive bombs and the city police and everything, they dropped a bomb on the house of the MOVE commune. In there were 11 people. I mean, and four of them were children. They were killed in the firebomb, the fire explosion that happened. The mayor, Wilson Good, who is black, actually agreed to let the fire burn. So it burned not only the people in the house, the MOVE family in the house, but also burned down all the buildings, 60 things. This was actually in Center Philadelphia. It was in a black, you know, predominantly black neighborhood in the city, you know, center area. So this all happened. The only survivor, two survivors of that firebombing, one was Ramona Africa. She was the only adult survivor, and one 11-year-old boy at the time. So this is all part of the background of Philadelphia, and they all know Mumia. So you want me to get to
what's new now? We're running out of time. Yeah. Now I want you to tell us what's new. It has to do with the fact that I guess the court agreed that Mumia's concert, there was a bias that undermined and violated Mumia's constitutional rights.
So there's a fundamental constitutional right that you're supposed to have unbiased, impartial tribunals whether you're talking about a trial judge or an appeals judge. These are one of those things that exist as a principle of American constitutional law that are violated more than upheld. In any event, without having the time to go through the whole story, after all of Mumia's appeals have been denied, and all the attempts to make sure that we got rid of a biased judge in Mumia's case and on the appeals, there was a new Supreme Court decision dealing with one Ronald Castile, who was a justice and then chief justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. This just happened in 2016. Castile also, before that, was the district attorney responsible for answering and upholding all of Mumia's conviction. He was the district attorney during all of Mumia's appeals. And so to make this sort of as clear as I can, is that basically Castile, at the time that we were appealing all of Mumia's post-conviction denials from this Judge Sabo, this racist and pro-cop, judge, one of the justices on the Supreme Court was the very same DA who had fought against a lot of the issues that Mumia was bringing right up on the appeal process to the Supreme Court, which he now was going to sit and rule on. Castile himself ran on there's elected judges there. So he ran on a program of saying that he was for law and order. He was responsible for putting 45 people on death row. He dealt with the most notorious cases, and very importantly, he said that he was, supported by the Fraternal Order of Police. He had gotten awards from them. He got financial support from them, all of that. So we made, while I was counsel, we made a motion for Castile to recuse himself and not participate in any of the hearings, any of the appeals that went into 1998. Castile refused, saying he had nothing to do with Mumia's case. The same thing happened in the next rounds of appeals that Mumia had from new issues that came up in 2004 and 2008 and 2012, and Castile sat there. So based upon the new Supreme Court decision that said, you can't do this. You cannot be a judge when you've been a prosecutor in a case and had some involvement in it. So on that basis, new action was taken for Mumia about 2.5 years ago. It was gone through what they call discovery and information for this past time. And just a few days ago, on the 27th of December, the judge sitting there, Judge Leon Tucker, said that Mumia's rights to an impartial appeal process were violated because Castile sat on all the Supreme Court decision-making bodies denying Mumia's appeals, and that created the appearance of bias and a lack of impartiality, and then violated his right to an impartial, neutral appeal process. And on that basis, Mumia has been granted the right to reappeal all of these issues, which is the issues of his innocence, of the fact of the frame-up and all its different aspects, as well as all the other issues about jury selection and all that. Wow. Meanwhile, what we're facing, this is huge. This gives Mumia,
amazing.
I've written about
that's
this a lot.
That's the whole Megillah
that's
there.
Everything. It's the whole enchilada, as
oh
they
my
say
God.
In some ways, including the fact that Sabo, his trial judge, and also was the judge during the hearings while I was co-counsel from 95 to 98, basically is also somebody who violated the due process rights because of his bias against Mumia, and we had made a motion for him to recuse himself, which he, of course, denied. So, and there is like a dozen grounds. Which if any one of them were granted by a new panel of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, entitles Mumia to a minimum of new trial, though I would argue that the level of judicial as well as prosecutorial and police misconduct is so great that the charges should be dismissed against Mumia in any event.
Wow.
So all this is going on, and our one obstacle, I do have to take a minute or two to say this, our huge obstacle right now is the so-called progressive district attorney Larry Krasner, who is being, you know, touted all around the country as, you know, the face of, you know, we can reform the system from within and, you know, getting rid of mass incarceration, et cetera, et cetera. He has been opposed to Mumia's petition from the day he got into as elected DA in January, the beginning of last year, 2018. And we knew that he was going to be opposed to Mumia's case, because what he did when he got elected is he put this Ronald Castile on his advisory board, not more than a year after the United States Supreme Court had castigated this guy, said that he had committed gross judicial misconduct by sitting on other cases that he shouldn't have because of his bias. So this is what Krasner has done. He's now sitting, supposedly deciding on what he's going to do. He's met with Maureen Faulkner, the widow of the police officer who was killed, and the Fraternal Order of Police. He has refused to meet with Mumia's brother and Mumia's supporters, though that he was asked to do that. And he has fought tooth and nail against Mumia's petition.
So what are you asking people to do? What's the bottom line? What do you? I know you want people to do some things. What is that?
Okay, well, the broadest thing, of course, is we're fighting in every way for Mumia's freedom. But as an immediate thing, we are asking people to call DA Larry Krasner and tell him not to appeal this decision. If he appeals this decision that Judge Tucker granted of Mumia getting new appeal rights, we will be tied up for 4 years and appealing and fighting to defend this decision that Mumia just got, this historic decision. Mumia is now almost 65 years old. He's, had Hep C. He's got a skin ailment that still leaves itchy. He's got glaucoma. You know, he's not a young man anymore, even though you wouldn't know that by all the things he writes. We want Mumia out as soon as possible. And in a minimum, that means we need to be able to proceed to these new appeal process. That's what we need to do. And that means, Castile, that Krasner needs to decline to appeal this. And, of course, he's under pressure, which, of course, he's been from the beginning, which is why he put Castile on his advisory board, to basically buy Maureen Faulkner and the Fraternal Order of Police. To do this appeal. So we are calling on people to call Larry Krasner or to email him and tell him very simply, do not appeal Judge Tucker's decision reinstating appeal rights for Mumia.
What are those addresses?
Okay, so the phone number is 215-686-8000.
And who is this again?
This is DA Larry Krasner.
Okay, give that number again.
Okay, 215-686-8000. Or you can tweet him at Phila, PHILA, capital DAO for District Attorney Office, and the same message saying, do not appeal Judge Tucker's decision. They will know what that means. And they've already gotten phone calls, they said, from all around the world. We've put out this notice internationally, of course, as well as nationally. And on Friday is a Twitter storm being set up, and that's to tweet the DA's office.
Is there a website now that people can go to and go over this stuff again?
Yes, the best website to go that's got all this information on it right now is Mobilization for Mumia. That's the number for Mumia. And you go into the actions section on the top thing, and it has all this information on
Mobilization
it.
For Mumia.
Mumia.
Wow.
What would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers?
Somewhere on the streets of Houston this evening, a killer of children is lurking. He has seen the same media coverage surrounding the death of his victim, you and I have. And although the shock of a child dying still reverberates across Texas, it has not yet convinced him to accept responsibility for his actions. Jasmine Barnes was just 7 years old, no doubt enjoying the trip to the grocery store with her mother and three sisters last Sunday morning when the red pickup truck pulled up alongside and the driver opened fire. There is at least one report the shooter then sped up to get in front of them, slowed down, and fired again. So this could not have been an accidental discharge. The multiple bullets entering mom's car wounded her, injured a 6-year-old daughter, and killed Jasmine. Her panicked sisters knew right away she was in trouble, screaming to their mother, "She's not moving." As their assailant disappeared, the search for him got underway. Now, first reports of a bearded suspect, well, they have been discounted. Now the hunt is on for a thin white male, 40s, wearing a black hoodie, blue eyes. Burying a 7-year-old. Think about what that means for a moment for all of us left behind. Next Monday, when Houston school children return to class, there will be an empty desk in one second grade classroom. Well, at the same time, somewhere on the streets of Houston, an unrepentant killer of children will be lurking.
Black babies cost less.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, January 5, 2019. So I have been told. Compensatory call-in, dial-in if you have thoughts, observations, questions, counter-racist suggestions. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Few things to share before we get to listeners. A number of things to share. Incidentally, the situation with Jasmine Barnes, the 7-year-old black female, black girl who was murdered in Houston, Texas. That situation right there, murdered by a suspected race soldier, white male, that has yet to be arrested, identified. That situation right there, another reason why Gus T. does not have children. That is the system of white supremacy. In fact, for folks who are with us for the book club, Richard Williams, Venus and Serena Williams' father, Black and White, The Way I See It, where he talked about when one of his children was being born, I think it was Venus. He was outside the delivery room and he was just screaming like, "Oh my God, you know, my child is going to be a victim of white supremacy racism." And he just started screaming and his wife heard him. I'm surprised he didn't get tased and beaten. They would have had a resource officer in the hospital now and we don't allow, you know, loud, unruly niggers in the hospital or anywhere else for that matter. But that right there is why I, or one reason why I do not have offspring. I've heard that from others as well. Many things to share this here week. Start with number one. I've talked a lot about yoga. 2018. It's been one full year. I cannot believe it. Number one, I cannot believe it. Most importantly, because it's been a year since the flood and nothing has changed. Still a displaced victim of white supremacy and a flood victim a year later. Anywho, but a year of yoga, I've said, with all the weight loss, 90 pounds, feeling great. Wowee. I have really not said enough about, oh yes, and that's a year of being vegan as well. I will give a great anecdote. Two friends, both victims of white supremacy, non-white people, right here in good old Seattle, best plantation this part of the world. They were planning to have a kind of New Year, or I guess you'd call it quote unquote holiday pizza party. It's going to be pizza and chicken. And both of them, you know, cook. One in particular cooks a lot, loves to cook. Excellent cook and make a lot of things by scratch. Many, many people always look forward to, you know, his vittles, whatever he's going to be cooking up. So, and he normally, if it's going to be pizza, making the dough by scratch and, you know, all of that. So they know I've been vegan. They've watched me go from being, you know, super tubby and out of shape to being vegan now and yoga and all of that. So the day before they're going to do a pizza party, and this is going to be a pizza party with chicken wings as well. So pizza and chicken and probably some other zaniness as well. So for me to be in attendance, the catch was they were going to have vegan pizza as well. So I could eat and everything is be okay. So we're there the day before. We're talking about food and diet. Incidentally, one of these individuals, black female, I've talked about her before. She's participated in the program. She is a mother, two times over, in fact. And she's talking about wanting to get her weight back to what it was before she had her first child, which, you know, a lot of people struggle with that, especially in the system of racism, white supremacy, particularly black moms, the stress of racism. They do not make it easy for a variety of reasons. So we're talking about diet and, you know, she's talking about my vegan diet and things that I eat, things that I don't eat and why. And so we end up watching this documentary about food and being vegan. There are many of them. I mean, you could pick, you know, whichever one. So we watched this documentary and we're talking about it more. At the end of it, they decide instead of doing the chicken pizza party as planned, they take back all of the chicken. They take back all of the cheese. They end up having all vegan pizza, no chicken. Instead of chicken, they do air-fried mushrooms, which were out of this world. You have to have an air fryer, I guess, which is not too expensive, it seems. But wow, absolutely amazing air-fried mushrooms. But it was great. There was not a single complaint. There were about a dozen guests, and it was devoured. I didn't hear anybody gripe and complain that there was no dairy on the cheese. It was great. And they have been vegan for, I guess, close to 2 weeks now. So not that that means you can't be unhealthy just because you are vegan. That does not mean that you're eating fresh fruits and vegetables on a regular basis. You could be vegan and just be eating Oreo cookies and, you know, potato chips every day and right on. But vegan, healthy eating, that can have a huge impact on how you feel, how you look, just so many things, so many things. And that has been a big part of the past year in trying to offset the enormous stress of being a displaced flood victim. Diet is very important. Dr. Kanban talked about that. Vegan, man, ditching those animal products, very, very important. Hopefully we'll have some broadcasts on that moving forward. Other things before we get to the callers. We are listener-supported Counter-Racist Radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can visit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. Tremendous gratitude to all of the investors who have supported a decade. We have been broadcasting. It is 2019, a decade that we have been on the air. That is because of listeners who have kept us broadcasting. Much obliged. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. In addition, you can visit the Amazon wish list. It's linked at Amazon, Gus T. Renegade. The link for it is on my blog right under the PayPal button. But tremendous thanks to all the folks who have nabbed items from the wish list over the years. Again, I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Hopefully providing constructive information on what white supremacy racism is, how it works. Can you believe it? I'm here in Seattle. Instead of being able to enjoy in the rowdy madness of Saturday night playoff football, Seattle and the Dallas Cowboys. Do you know I was here in Seattle when Tony Romo, Dallas Cowboys, played and he fumbled the ball? I was here. I was right down the street from the stadium When that play happened, I don't remember the year, but I was right here in Seattle. But instead of doing that and being at the local tavern and having my pom-poms and cheering, we are here to talk about the system of white terrorism. Other things that were important, some of the things that popped up from the clips. The segment about the stolen calculators. I so wish I had done a rewind with that segment because they said that they called out riot gear, enforcement officers in riot gear, to go to a black grandmother's house, presumably, for calculators. Now, if they have examples of white grandmothers' houses being raided for stolen calculators or pencil sharpeners or any other items that you could steal from a high school, I would like to know. But that is where, and for multiple reasons, because when I heard that, and then later on in the segment, the victim, VGQ, Victims Guarantee Qualified, the victim said, well, you know, I'm not saying that every white officer or that this white officer was out to, you know, go hunt and harm a black person. I'm not saying that at all. They sent riot gear. They said they had forensics data collected. They had an investigation for calculators. What kind of calculators were these? I have had a calculator stolen at school. I do not remember it becoming like a CSI investigation type thing where we, you know, got expensive microscopes and, you know, this is going to be a $20,000 investigation and we're going to bring in outside agents and dust. Really? For calculator? Come on. The system of race. Did they do all that? They had that incident, I think it was in Idaho, where a black male student was being sodomized. Did they have that sort of massive investment of time and energy to solve the problem when it was a black male victim of rape? Anyway, the terms that were used as well in that segment, marginalized, different from us, biases, these are all horrendous terms to use. In my view, whites deliberately will use these terms when talking about white supremacy racism, because they deliberately obfuscate. That is skilled use of words to practice racism. You don't call things by their correct name. These types of words, different from us, biases, this is white supremacy racism. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about, that's what they said. There are not even that many black students at the school. And then the handful that we had, or the small number of black students that are present, are presumed criminals and treated accordingly. That's what we're talking about. It's not different from us. They don't have examples of white students being in predominantly black schools and they're immediately thought of as rapists and criminals, and riot clad enforcement officials are sent to their grandmother's residence for stolen calculators. That is not because they're different from us and they're marginalized at the predominantly Negro school. I don't hear those reports. Continuing, the segment about the fluoride in the water, I thought was important. System of racism, white supremacy, it can be difficult to ascertain truth. Number one weapon is deception. So whites lie about many different things. And in addition to that, sometimes just figuring out when you have whites who have disagreements, like this is one where you have a substantial number of whites who say, hey, that fluoride stuff is bad. I don't want it in the water. I don't want it in my toothpaste. I don't want it at all. I don't want the fluoride tablets. It's horrible. And then you have other whites saying, hey, it's great. It's awesome. I can even pause for 1 second. That is another great illustration of STEM and why we need lots and lots of black people to pursue science. Dr. Welsing talked about this, so that we can have our own counter-racist labs where we can do our own studies and we don't have to be reliant on whites, race soldiers, to tell us what's what about fluoride or anything else. Anyway, with the fluoride situation, before I was interested pursuing counter-racism, I did know black people who were very interested in fluoride and vegan eating, and they would talk about fluoride all the time, and they were opponents of fluoride in the toothpaste, fluoride in the drinking water. They were not with that. The position that they took, which was so counter-racist logic, the position that they took, and this was before I had read Mr. Fuller, I didn't know, you know, anything about his work, but the position that they took was, there seems to be a question about this fluoride thing. Even white people don't seem to have consensus about this. Until that's resolved, how about minimize the sugar? As opposed to you putting whatever chemicals in the water or my toothpaste, how about let's take the soda machines out of the school? And that's the other thing with the contradictions with white people. It can be real difficult to ascertain. It's like, well, wait a minute. You put water, put fluoride in the water. Not to mention, we can't even get the lead out of the water where the Negroes happen to live, but whatever. So you put the fluoride and lead probably in the water, you say for my benefit. Then you come back and you put soda machines in the school. And you put sugar in everything. You can't get a product that doesn't have sugar in it. Most of the time it's white sugar. Maybe if we minimize the sugar, we wouldn't need the fluoride at all. How about that? Let's try that. That was the argument that my pal used to take, which is so super logical. And in my view, that's counter-racist logic, since there are a lot of whites who, I hear them all the time right here in Seattle. I don't want the fluoride in my water. No, sir. No, ma'am. I don't want the tablets either. I'm good. If that's the case, let's just do some of the other things that would be great to promote dental health. And then we don't have to worry about the fluoride. We can pause on that since there still seems to be a question. Continuing. They talked about so-called class bias that was stated in the segment on Mumia Abu-Jamal slipped in, which I did think was important to get all the additional information about Mumia. I think a lot of people don't know all the details of his case and how he has been in greater confinement for decades now. But in that segment, class bias, I thought that was important because we also heard the segment where they were talking about black people not getting the same access to pain medication from emergency medical responders, and that being racism, white supremacy. And they said that this happened irrespective of class. That's what I say all the time. That is another one in terms of words, concepts being injected in conversations of racism, white supremacy to deliberately cause confusion. It's not about class. Doesn't matter how much money or whatever else you have, which can be taken back immediately in the system of racism, white supremacy. Bill Cosby. That is totally irrelevant. It is just about mistreating individuals who are classified as not white, especially those who are classified as black. That health segment I thought was important for a number of reasons. Speaking of Mumia and the Black Panther Party, that was one of the key things that they were problems that they were trying to address, black people having poor access to ambulances and medical care in the 1960s. In fact, in some areas, in North Carolina being one, the Black Panther Party started their own ambulance service because of the poor quality service that black people had. In some cases, no services. That obviously was leading to deaths and poor quality health. That is the system of racism, white supremacy. But that segment also reminded me of one of our guests, Dr. John Hoberman, again, Cal's decade, 10 years. Dr. John Hoberman, he was on the program multiple times. In fact, he was on to discuss Black and Blue, which is a book, I think it came out in 2012. He's at the University of Texas, Austin, White Man Suspected Racist. That book is about racism in the health industry. And one of the key themes of the book is that exactly what you heard in that segment, the white doctors, you have all this evidence, undeniable racism, white supremacy being practiced in the health field, medical apartheid. However, nobody, not a nurse, not a doctor, no one will say, not an EMT, no one will say, oh yeah, I'm a racist. Or at least Ted over there, you see that gal with the, stethoscope? Oh yeah, she's a racist. And she voted for Donald Trump. Never, never happens. Everybody's, oh, none of us are racist. Maybe it's that unconscious bias thing. Maybe got a little of that going on. But racist here? No way. And his whole book is, well,
wait a minute, if you look at the people who are doctors, let's just look at who these folks are. They're white people. They make a lot of money. They tend to have very conservative politics, whatever that means. And he just goes down and say, hey, these would tend to be people that you might think of as being, yeah, this sounds like a racist. And then you look at all the results. It just, in my view, he could have been more clear. But the basic point is, so all quite a few of these people have got to be racist. This has got to be a lie to just keep saying that you see all these results popping up and they're not racist. Come on, the unconscious bias. Stop lying. What does it mean to be white? That's one of the main questions we've asked for 10 years. Stop being confused about why these things happen. Metaphors. There were so many metaphors, as there are most weeks that are used. Let's see, this week we had out of the dark when discussing the civil rights cases from the 1960s. Let's see, we had cockroaches scatter. That was another one. Discussing the civil rights cages, cockroaches scatter when you bring light to a situation. I have no idea how that applies to the system of racism, white supremacy. I have not seen whites discontinue the practice of racism just because it is being discussed. In Mumia's case, they referenced the judge in the case, Albert Sabo, suspected racist. They said he was the king of death row. I thought that was a great metaphor to deconstruct, because king of death row, that implies like pride, like people, I mean, the king, that is the very definition of someone being proud and chest out, head up high about what you're doing, killing black people. Really, that's death row. That's what they've been saying since I've been alive. Disproportionate number of black people on death row. Mumia was one of them for decades. But I am proud of killing people. I take pride in doing this. In fact, I'm the king of it. I don't just take pride. I do this better than anybody. That's what the metaphor king of death row, that's what it suggests to me. An enjoyment. That's something I think Mr. Fuller emphasizes. I think that's something that I've stressed as well. Whites enjoy mistreating black people. They're not ignorant about this. They enjoy practicing white supremacy racism. Even the Jasmine Barnes situation, I submit, they enjoy practicing racism, white supremacy. Speaking of, and before I get to metaphors, just words, terms being important, they referred to Mumia Abu-Jamal as a radical journalist. I put that one up there with militant. Those both of those terms, I have no idea what that means. And generally, I think of those as pejorative terms, meaning these are not really compliments. It's generally, if there is a non-white person, a black person who is revealing truth about racism, white supremacy, they will generally try to use these type of terms like, oh, my goodness, maybe you're saying some things that you shouldn't say. My goodness, I don't know. This is kind of getting to the boundary of what is acceptable. It's generally the way that I hear people describe, or that's generally what is suggested when these types of terms are used to describe black people discussing racism. Radical, militant. We've talked about these terms for a while on the program. Metaphors. If we could not use those, that would be super helpful. Frequently racist, they will use metaphors to spread deception, confusion. Frequently, they will insist that two concepts are identical. And frequently, that is not the case at all. Victims of racism, Gus T. included, we have been exposed to this misconduct for a number of years. And many of us, myself included, are still learning. As such, we have not come to conclusions on some matters, which is fine. It just means that sometimes we don't have logic to fully articulate our thoughts. So we will rely on a metaphor, analogy, comparison. And frequently that does not aid in minimizing confusion. Often it just creates more confusion. And that's what we're trying to stop. So if we need more time to think, that's great. But if we could not use metaphors, if we could speak directly, specifically to what it is that we want to say, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about that. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, questions, observations, that would be great. That'll make sure that everyone has at least one chance to speak.
If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could please use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. Just make sure that no one has to fight over a lot of unnecessary noise and distractions. Much obliged. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. First few folks who dialed in, if you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. I think, was that Mr. Steele?
Yes, it was.
Proceed, sir.
Awesome. This is Kent Steele. I'm calling in live from Los Angeles in the Koreatown section. And I just want to say that I'm enjoying some beef tacos that I got from a street vendor. And I feel great. And also, I just wanted to say that I regularly post pictures of, you know, some of my, you know, fitness, you know, results on my page. And, you know, people ask me, you know, what are some diet tips that I have and everything like that. And, you know, one thing that I do quite regularly, maybe daily, almost daily, is I'll have a cheeseburger from McDonald's. Sometimes I'll have a Big Mac, but if you look at the macro content of those foods, you'll see that, yeah, you're getting a lot of protein per calorie, and on top of that, it's super easy to digest, so, you know, you can get ripped, and you can look great while eating meat. You know, I don't want to denigrate meat eating or anything like that, and I think it's a viable option for good health. Also, I just wanted to say that, you know, this week there's been a lot of what seems to be manufactured outrage about this whole R. Kelly situation. And there's a documentary that was recently released that, I guess, details allegations about some sort of sexual impropriety or whatever. I think that some good training that victims of racism should demonstrate is that whenever suspected white supremacists are, attacking a victim of racism in the media about some sort of, you know, one of these Me Too style allegations, I think the smart thing for all victims to do is to either say, hey, I don't believe any of these allegations, or at the very minimum, I need to see concrete evidence, more evidence that you would need than you would need to convict a white police officer of shooting a black unarmed black person. So I say this because that's the standard that they use when judging their own, and it seems to be working for them. The situation is that I don't think we have the luxury of having the nuance that some people are trying to show whenever they're explaining these sort of issues or talking about these issues. Because what you get is you get a whole bunch of people giving credibility to the arguments that they're proposing. And then in the same breath or in the same sentence, turning around and saying that that doesn't matter. A few things. One, Cosby is not a rapist. Two, OJ is not a murderer. And three, you know, this may be hard to say in this type of environment, but R. Kelly, from the evidence that we can see, he was acquitted in a court of law, so he's officially not a pedophile. So please, you know, be very careful when participating in these media events. Be very careful in when you interpret some of the media that's coming out, especially as it pertains to Black people. And your default stance, for its sanity's sake, would be, I think it would be smart to just say, I don't believe you and I don't care, and then keep it moving. I'm going to go ahead and mute my line at this point. Thank you so much, Gus. You have a wonderful evening.
I don't know what would make that hard to say or hear on this broadcast, but much obliged, Mr. Steele. Me Too style allegations, that is a metaphor. Other folks who dialed in that we have not heard from, line should be open. Proceed.
Good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Just to touch on, or just to kind of reiterate on one of the points that Mr. Steele just made regarding R. Kelly, that is on social media quite a bit. And for me, it's just really making Black people in general and Black males specifically, just to make them synonymous with just depravity or just anything that's considered illegal or just bad things in general. And I'm trying to encourage people not to participate with these postings, but I'm just seeing a lot of anti-Blackness surrounding that. And again, I just encourage everyone to stay away from it as well. Also, Gus, with that phrase that you were during the segment about the, I guess, the school resource officers and how they were, you know, discussing that situation, and that phrase "different from us," to me, it also implies that, you know, let's say the, you know, a certain either police officer or resource officer is, you know, non-white, then us could be, you know, practicing racism too. So the word "us" was not defined as white people as it really should have been on that segment, but just saying "us," meaning depending on who it is, whether it's a black person or any other non-white person, they could be doing the same thing as what white people do. So it was kind of implying that with that phrase as well. And that's what I gathered from that. And lastly, I'd like to discuss again with social media. I'm seeing this a lot, and I'm sure others have noticed this as well. But there's, and again, it's promoting anti-Blackness and just, you know, victimizing Black people and name calling. There'll be some sort of post to where it would suggest that someone has done something to you that would be considered disrespectful, so to speak. So let's say, for instance, it would say, "What would you do?" And there would be a picture of maybe, and, you know, forgive me if this is offending anyone, but if your, you know, teenage daughter brought her, you know, boyfriend over to the house, and he's the boyfriend, and, you know, your teenage daughter is in your bed, and they're, it could be, I don't know, engaging in some type of sexual activity, or maybe they're, the boyfriend is in your bed eating your food or your dinner, what was supposed to be your dinner that night. And it'll say, again, a caption would say, "What would you do?" And then you get a lot of replies and responses. You know, it would be usually a violent act, or I'm going to, you know, inflict violence upon my daughter and her boyfriend, or name calling, and just all types of stuff. And I'm seeing these posts, and a lot of Black people participating in it. Again, it's just promoting anti-Blackness, violence against Black people, name calling. And specifically when I'm saying name calling, there will be other posts where they will maybe post, it can be a Black male or female, and they would be dressed in a
I guess, an extremely faddish way or something that would be considered, and maybe this is a metaphor, ghetto, or they would be dressed, again, what would be considered outlandish, and they would say one word. So it's just, and the post would say one word. What would you say? What would you call this in one word? And, you know, the name calling would commence with all the replies, you know, hood rat, or, you know, just all types of stuff. So again, it's just promoting anti-blackness. And I'm just seeing a lot of black people participating in this. And I just think it's just really important that, you know, we focus, discipline ourselves as well as our children or anyone within our influence to not do that. It's disgusting, and but it's pretty popular on social media, and I'll say Facebook to be more specific. And that's all I have to share right now. Thank you.
Much obliged, sir. Use of time and energy as well. The anti-blackness, for sure. Lots of that gets encouraged. Use of time and energy. We have so many problems. It's got to be a million other things that we could be doing that are more important than that sort of hypothetical violence. Other folks who chimed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everybody. First, I'll start off by saying I've been spending a lot of time visiting in the hospital, in the hospitals. I think, as I mentioned before, the person that I've been visiting now, it went from my mother to my son's mother. It's a marketable age difference. Nevertheless, she's been in the hospital, different hospitals now, since November. And it's in the process of sitting with her over a period of time, and this was a couple of days ago, and in turn she mentioned that she needed to go to the bathroom. So I alerted the hospital personnel to assist her, because she can't walk on her own. So I left to go in the corridor to this. It's like a picture window that you can look out the window down the hall from her room. But then about, I heard some chatter. It wasn't in her room, but, you know, across the hallway, where I could hear some personnel state, well, he's getting violent now, so we're going to need some help. And so next thing I know, seconds later, they wheeled this black male out of his room. He was in, you know, traditional hospital gown, and he actually had the, I can't remember what it's called, when you get a tube hooked to your penis. And on the other end is the bag where you would urinate into, and you need to urinate. And basically, he had that kind of full. But anyway, for some reason, they wheeled him, the personnel wheeled him right next to me where I was sitting at in this area. Mind you now, it was other chairs and other areas that they could have wheeled him at, but they wheeled him right next to me for some reason. So I kind of looked over there, and my brain computer say, I know this guy from somewhere. I just couldn't put my, I guess, just couldn't be precise. Then it came to me that he was a person that I didn't know personally, but I knew of, because he was one of the greatest high school football players in this area. He came out, you know, a little bit older than I am, and he went on and played at University of Pittsburgh with a teammate of Hall of Fame running back Tony Dorsett. He was on that national championship team. His name was Artie Weatherington. And they were wrestling and fighting with him, and he was fighting back also. He didn't want to, I guess, cooperate in some kind of way. And one of the nurses was trying to give him a sedative on the end of a needle. And he was fighting, and he had a lot of power and whatnot. And they called almost every, the hallway was full of commotion and personnel and also security and that sort of thing. And I did my best to kind of calm him down. We knew of one another, but like I said, it's not like I had a personal contact with him. And I did my best to try to calm him down a little bit, say, it's all right, Artie, you know, just be cool, you know, blah, blah, blah. Try to, you know, calm him down so they wouldn't harm him. I believe he has some level of CTE, I believe. Actually, when he finished from college, he came back to South Florida and actually was a member of the Miami-Dade County Police that's affiliated with Dade County Public Schools and achieved the rank of major. So it wasn't like he's some sort of dissolute person and whatnot. He retired, you know, from that particular job. But things worked out. Things worked out eventually. He was, next thing I know, he was sitting there in the hallway eating on his own. Today, with the DCS program was a traditional thing that Mr. Clark calls the etiquette training. He has a black female that is a professional in that particular subject, and she basically shares her information with these black males. Basically, it's a situation that prepares them of the means and ways of networking, I guess, with white people, primarily. VGQ, as far as I'm concerned, VGQ. And so that's basically what took place today. But I did enter in an interesting conversation with one of the quote-unquote mentors. He is a physician, a doctor. A physician, to be exact, went to Med Harry College, and he was talking about this old adage that some more, I would say, intellectual white people engage in, talking about class over race, and he said that he was a member of this group that's called the Dream Something. I guess can't think of the last part of that name. I know the first part of it starts with Dream. I actually went to one of their rallies. You actually have to pay to go in there, but I just wanted to see exactly what it was. And I remember going to it, and the first thing I observed, without even listening to anything, you know, observed was, the people that were up on the stage primarily were a whole lot of very light-skinned, quote-unquote, non-white black people, whereas the more heavily melanated people were doing the work, like passing out papers and keeping the place clean and things of that nature. And it was, I'm suspicious, of course, of any organization that has white people in it that claims that they are doing something correct. And but anyway, the conversation was constructive, I think, because I basically made it my best to stay in the lane of practicing constructive
30 seconds
codification, constructive codification. So that's basically how things went this week. And thank you for listening.
Much obliged. Retired firefighter in Florida. See other folks who dialed in with a hand up that we have missed completely. If you have commentary to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Gus and callers. This is Draftomania. And I just wanted to make a comment regarding the fluoride. I wanted to read a couple of things regarding fluoride in the water. I have done extensive research on fluoride, and something that I just researched, it says, at the end of the Second World War, the United States government sent Charles Elliott Perkins, a research worker in chemistry, biochemistry, physiology, and pathology, to take charge of the vast farming chemical plants in Germany. While there, he was told of a scheme which had been worked out by them during the war and adopted by the German staff, German general staff. This was to control the population in any given area through mass medication, drinking water. In this scheme, sodium fluoride occupied a prominent place. Repeated doses of fluoride will in time reduce an individual's power to resist domination by slowly poisoning and necrotizing a certain area of the brain, and will thus make him submissive to the will of those who wish to govern him. Both the Germans and the Russians added sodium fluoride to drinking water of prisoners of war to make them stupid and docile. And then another article says, in 1930, a dense layer of populated fog settled over the Neuse Valley, a heavily industrial area in eastern Belgium, killing 60 people and sickening thousands. After lengthy and careful investigation, Roholm determined that gaseous fluoride compounds were responsible. Roholm also identified aluminum smelters as emitters of large quantities of gases. So fluoride has been used as biological weapons, and it's also it's also a toxic waste that they've been using to put it add into the water, just basically because they didn't know what to do with fluoride. I'm pretty sure most of the callers did know that, but I just wanted to share some information on that. So when they say I take the stance that you take, and the other individual, your other friend that said instead of putting fluoride in water, the counter-racist code would be, why don't we just stop adding sugar or stop eating so much sugar and using, you know, putting the vending machines and things like that in the school systems. Maybe that would cut down the chances of the students having cavities. That would seem to be the most logical thing to do. And also, I wanted to make a comment in regards to Mumia. I did go to that website, his website earlier this week. It signed the petition for his release. And I, while we were listening to as I was listening to your clips, I did have an opportunity to visit the site regarding the music by Black composers. And I also visited the website for Vanguard STEM. And I also wanted to say, Gus, that I have been listening to the audio book and the audio in the archives for 2000 seasons. And I am very much enjoying that book. I really don't think I would be able to comprehend the book if I was not listening to the audio book. I don't think I would be able to comprehend it on a deeper level as I am able to by listening to the analysis that the Cal's listeners are giving on that book. And I think it's just I think it's great. And I'm also reading Yerugal. So that's all I basically wanted to share, and thank you so much.
Reading is more important than watching television. Yerugu, Dr. Marimba Ani, first book in the book club. Top 10, top 5, actually. Ayi Kwe'i Arma, 2000 Seasons. I read that one. Ned did the narration for that one way back when in the Cal's Book Club. Incidentally, the Mumia case, people should definitely be mindful of that court case if there ends up being another trial or anything, because they had the white wife of the deceased officer in this case. She was on Fox News giving an interview, and I mean, talk about weeping white woman. And you know, I've had to go through this for decades. I think they had her ushered out of the courtroom recently during one of the proceedings. And I mean, how dare you know, you have a white woman excused from a courtroom for this nigra. I mean, oof. Be mindful of this case. I could see if I would be stunned if they have this case, particularly if anything major happens. Donald Trump, I would think, President Donald J. Trump would have something to say about this case. Incidentally, we should perhaps read Live from Death Row. That's one of the books that Mumia Abu-Jamal wrote. If we have any folks, since I'm wrapping up The Man Not This Friday, if we have any folks who would be interested in reading Live from Death Row, it's not very long. Let me know, untiljustice@gmail.com. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Emmy. Good to hear from you.
Greetings, beautiful people. I wanted to comment on the experience that Black people have in hospitals and in the ER and ambulances and whatnot. I'm of the opinion that our not being prescribed pain medication is not necessarily the most accurate form of investigating whether or not we receive proper treatment in the ER emergency room situation, primarily because the pain medication that they're referring to are addictive medications, they're addictive chemicals. And I don't think enough study has been conducted that we're aware of that can truly illuminate how those drugs affect brains with melanin. And they are highly addictive, and they're addictive kind of at the onset. I think the proper word is tachyphylaxis. It's kind of like once you do it one time, you're already, your immunity to it is kind of decreased, so you need more and more and more. And so that leads to cellular downregulation and all this other, all these other cellular processes. And so I don't, like, I've never been in extreme pain where I've, like, broken a limb or something like that, and I've required these type of medications. So I'm not saying that they don't have medical therapeutic indexes or uses. However, I think that I keep hearing that that is the measurement of our treatment in hospital situations. And I think that that's dangerous because there's enough evidence to suggest that people classified as white are suffering from this opioid addiction crisis because they have been overly prescribed these medications because for whatever reason, right? They got it. Doctors gave it to them. Now everybody's addicted to it. And it's an American crisis, a white people crisis, right? But for some reason now, everyone wants to say that, you know, we're being mistreated because we're not getting as much as they were getting. I don't think we need as much as they're getting, you know, these. So that's the end of that. However, there are other things that we can use, historical documentation and even, you know, like relevant current things that are happening in hospital situations. For instance, I work in a hospital, and my job is to pretty much make sure that patients who are suffering from some type of mental psychosis, it could be addiction, it could be withdrawal, it could be alcoholism, it could be dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Huntington's, anything that would, schizophrenia, breaks, anything like that, that would cause someone to be a danger to themselves or others in a hospital where we're trying to get them better. So they could be pulling at their tubes. We don't want them to do that. They could have suicidal ideation. We don't want them to do that. You know, we need to keep them calm. And by law, you're not able to restrain people anymore. So people like me are brought in to hospitals to ensure safety. Now, I'm in Virginia, and I've been doing this now since, like, August. And, you know, for me, I'm a healthcare professional. I'm very clear about what I do. I get paid to do what I do. That's why I do what I do. you know, so that's it. So I get paid to go in and make sure this person, whatever, is safe during my shift. I leave, I collect my check. It is what it is. Of course, I'm always developing my code, practicing my code, and observing, experimenting as well. And so it took me all up until a little while ago. I pulled like a bunch of double shifts because I was trying to make the money. I had only provided this service to white people. And I thought, well, that's strange, you know, because we're the ones that's supposed to be like super addicted, right? Like we're the ones that's supposed to be going through all this stuff with drugs. We're the ones that are so sick and stuff, yet where are we in this hospital and why am I not being brought in to help anybody out? It just doesn't add up to me. All these white people from all the ranges of disease states that I've, you know, mentioned before, until I finally, of the like many people I've helped, two black people. And it's amazing to see like how pain medication is like the first thing, you know, it's like that's what white people want. So I want to just say, I don't think we need it. I think it's, you know, just it behooves us not to think that we need to be prescribed pain medication in order for us to be treated correctly in hospitals. And I just think it's amazing because I do see us in hospitals, but they just don't get the service I get. So it leads me to believe that that doesn't mean that we're not suffering from dementia or Alzheimer's or anything. Forget where we are. Wake up like, well, oh, my God, I have a catheter. Like, what's up? And you try to yank on it. But instead of bringing in someone like me to not sedate you, you get sedated. So I'm not so sure that that whole article thing or whatever it was is accurate, because I don't think that we're not suffering from these things as well. Yeah, I think that's it. I think that's all I wanted to say. So I thank you all for listening.
Much obliged, Emmy. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in that we missed completely, if you have a hand up, I'll give out the number one more time, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks, we missed completely. If you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Good evening. I just wanted to comment real quick because I don't want to spend too much time on it because I think I've and other people have been inundated with it. But the whole lifetime special, whatever, with R. Kelly, I would just say, from what I have observed, it seems to me that black females have pretty much made up in their minds that only black males rape. And as a victim of child molestation, not only was I molested by a black male, but I was also molested by a black female. And I just find it problematic for this continued narrative that I hear that basically, like we've been talking, the book that we've been covering, apparently black males just don't get sexually abused or molested. And like I said, my dad had opened up and shared with me what took place with him being molested and abused sexually. And I just really have a problem with that. And I have a huge problem now with black females, because as we know, most of these homes are ran by single black mothers. So my immediate question, what's going on in your household? And I can pretty much run down the ballot of basically what pretty much transpired with me when the incidents occurred when I was at first with my mother. You know, why my dad pretty much kept me away from her. You know, like I said, over the years, we've gotten back together, and you know, I don't talk about it with her because, like I said, she knows where I stand, and, you know, just she knows my position. And it's just sad. I don't even know. It's just, I'll finish up later, but I just had to get that off my chest because it's just been bothering me.
Much obliged, Princess. Thank you for sharing. I think I've said a number of times frequently with the system of white supremacy, the subject matter is not, you know, something that, yes, this is grand. You know, I feel wonderful to discuss this. Certainly, sharing about being sexually abused is not the most pleasant or enjoyable thing, but I appreciate you sharing. That is exactly what we have been reading. The Man Knot, Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood, Dr. Tommy J. Curry. Many of the points that he brings up, black males not being thought of as victims of sexual abuse, only being thought of as rapists of any and everything, everyone. Bidirectional domestic abuse, where black males and black females commit sexual abuse and domestic violence. A number of the major talking points from the book that we'll wrap up this Friday. I did want to say we have about 40 minutes left in the broadcast. We've gotten this far in the program where we've had, I think, at least three different folks give their commentary about the R. Kelly situation, which was a big deal this week, and zero commentary about Jasmine Barnes. Just something, really, more than anything, just pointing out, I think Mr. Fuller and others have made the point about how racists, they are extraordinary at being able to direct attention to say 2019, we'll have it so that R. Kelly will be the topic of discussion to start the new year. That is the system of white supremacy. We can direct attention here. We can direct attention there. Some things we talk about, some things we don't. Folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
I'll just, real quick, Gus, I'll just finish up with this, because I know you've made mention of it in the past, how the system works as far as their timing. I believe the this R. Kelly special was released on the, Thursday? And so I received an article on my newsfeed. It was a LA Times article basically saying that we need to begin to discuss making Sally Hemings the first lady. You know, they need to revisit her role and title and make her the first lady. And I, you know, as we all know, that's kind of problematic because she was a slave. She was 14 years old. Thomas Jefferson was 44. She's the half-sister of his wife. And it's just like, okay, we just finished off with R. Kelly, and then several hours later, this article comes up that posted yesterday. And, you know, while we were supposed to be covering this whole story, Jasmine and other issues, we're stuck with R. Kelly. Like that's for the past couple of days, that's just been the whole entire topic. And it's just like, we just like allow ourselves to be manipulated and off focus on stuff that, you know, doesn't even pertain to what we're living now, because all I see is just some washed up former groupies, and they must have ran out of their money and
they're taking a playbook from Cosby. That's just how I'm seeing it. And it takes away from real victims. I mean, last night I had a good conversation with a group of people on my page where we pretty much just opened up and shared stories about things that took place with us in our childhood, and both black males, like, there was no name calling, no male bashing, or nothing. Like, we should be able to do that as a collective. And I just think it's disingenuous for Lifetime, as well as this Tyrannosaurus Burks, to make this, documentary series.
30 seconds.
And it's just one-sided. But that's it for now.
Much obliged, Princess. Appreciate the commentary. I do think groupies is name-calling. I've never heard anyone identify themselves as a groupie. And playbook from Cosby, I think that is a metaphor. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Hey, is the light is clear? May I make a comment?
There are folks who've not shared at all, so I at least want to, unless all of them are in locations where they can't presently speak, people that we've not heard at all, did you all have commentary?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Vic, I'm out of Georgia. I didn't have much to say, but I did want to comment on the story about Jamar, forgot how to pronounce his first name. The lady that was talking about his case, the gentleman that was associated with the movement.
Mumia Abu Jamal.
I feel like it seemed like she was, to me, like buck is the worst. I don't know. Seemed like she wasn't getting to the point. And even the host had a reminder of the time. I can't think of what else I needed to comment on. I'll be my life.
Much obliged. That was the segment where I talked about the class portion that was interjected. The host didn't seem well prepared either, but moving forward. Other folks who dialed in that we missed completely, if you have commentary.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. This is Mahanji C. Greetings. I was going to make mention about Jasmine Barnes. I looked up the story very briefly. And so our people are getting killed. That's what white people do. White people kill black people. White people kill black people. And so every man needs to have a firearm, a gun, because that could have been rectified immediately. If you had a gun, you would have solved that problem. A man would have been able to solve that problem, or the mother would have been able to solve the problem. If she seen them, was able to identify them, then she was also able to draw a gun and place a shot and kill that person. And so would any other individual who was there. And then, so going back to what happened in Louisville, at the Kroger's, the black man that had a weapon prepared and was able to defend himself and defend all the other people who were there in Kroger's. I heard about that, the first reports that had come out, but the way that they had announced it was they made it into where it was nearly like speaking of it as a joke, to where they said that the black person And, well, they said the shooter, the two shooters, the active shooter, the white male who killed two black people, that white male, he was being shot at by a black male who had a gun. And the black male didn't hit the person. But I don't think he didn't hit the person because he couldn't hit the person. It's because, okay, so what happens after I kill this person? You know, I think he could hit. I've seen people shoot, and I know people do headshots. I've seen them be very, very accurate. I'm not saying I've seen people shoot people. I'm saying I've seen the targets. And I know that people are accurate. And so he defended himself. He defended all the other people. But that it could have been solved with this little girl. And then people need not to be able to get within a certain distance of you to where you can't be a deadly threat. Not that you want to harm people, but you don't want people to harm you. And we want to solve this problem immediately. White supremacy. We need to solve this problem immediately. Thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan DC. I guess my first response would be Emmanuel Bradford Jr. People forgot the shooting that happened in Alabama. We have listeners there in Alabama a few weeks ago, right at the end of the year, I think right around the time of what they call Black Friday. He was at a mall. A shooting happened. He was armed. Enforcement officials arrived. They did not shoot and or arrest the active shooter. They shot and killed Emmanuel Bradford Jr., a black male who was legally armed at the time. I say that in a system of racism, white supremacy, I do not think it is as simple as a black person having a gun, that will help solve problems in the system of white supremacy. It could be helpful in some instances. Sometimes Alton Sterling. Sometimes it might not be helpful, system of white supremacy. Lots of illustrations of black people having a gun, and it did not solve a problem. And for this situation specifically, I don't know how a gun would have solved, unless I missed something. If you're in a vehicle and a random race soldier just drives up beside you and begins shooting, unless you have the firearm like out, which most people that I'm aware of who are legally armed, that wouldn't be the case. It's not like they're driving down the street with their firearm in their lap or already with it in their hand. Like, I don't think having a gun in that situation would have helped either. I think it would have been so chaotic in that situation to even think that you would have been able to get the gun, maintain control of the vehicle. You've got your offspring in the car as well. They're being fired at. You're being fired at. Glass is flying all over you. That doesn't even seem reasonable for that situation. I think that a firearm would have made an impact, unless I am ignorant, which could be the case. Other folks who we have missed completely. Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Good evening to all. The little girl, Jasmine, terrible. They said that it was another similar case, same situation, a race soldier pulls up next to them, lets off shots into a black family's car a year earlier in the same exact area. What I took from this so far is I looked at the composite sketch of the person that the mother identified as the person who shot her. Shot her daughter and shot at her. And it looked like Steve Nash. I said to myself, just thinking, you know, it's very difficult for me, I think, to remember what a white person looked like because, you know, I guess I suffer from they all look alike. But when white people are on the news and they do a composite sketch of a black person, I mean, they're so detailed. Like, when they catch that black person, it's almost the same exact, like they observe us so well, you know, and I think that we kind of just look past them a lot of times. We don't look at them as much as a threat as we look at other black people. Drug abuse resistance education, that's called DARE, started by Daryl Gates in Los Angeles, made its way all the way to New Jersey. Jersey City in the 80s. I had it in school. So why would the ex-cop who went on
to get search warrants to go search these children's home because of pressure from their parents, who suspected only a small population of the black students in the school are stealing their calculators. An ex-cop who's now a lawyer, when they asked him about the incident of a theft of calculators and, you know, his response, you know, to these black children, he brings up the D.A.R.E. program. This had nothing to do with drugs. You know, this had nothing to do with that type of criminal activity at all. It's just, you know, a constant way of tying us to drugs. I think very slick in that lawyer's way he did it. But the black guy who became a lawyer, he's wasting his time. He lucky he wasn't walking around the school talking about white supremacy, black nationalism at the age of 16 like Mamiya, and ended up under FBI investigation for suspicion of terrorism at 16. And if the FBI is investigating someone for suspicion of terrorism and they're in a public place and they kill someone, there's no way the FBI wouldn't come with the evidence to prove without a reasonable doubt that you killed that person. So that should automatically let you know that something's up there. Keeping it in Philly, I read a story in an article this week about a mummers parade. Never heard of it before in my life. Mummers, M-U-M-M-E-R-S. But what caught my attention was they had the picture of a black man dressed up with a shirt and jacket that said Jay-Z with his hat to the side like Jay-Z. And he had a leash around the white man's neck, and the white man was crawling. He had a pointy nose like Pinocchio on all fours like a dog. And he had a shirt that said he was the mayor of Philadelphia. And I said, I can't believe it. So I did some research into his mummers. And before that, I mean, it made me think, what is white people's fetish with dressing up in costumes? You know, we have the Halloween parade here in New York. We have SantaCon. We have the Mermaid Parade. I mean, this is in Philadelphia. They have a mummers parade where people just dress up and get to be, I guess, something else. I don't get it, but just everyone, please do some research on this mummers parade. Goes right into blackface. Excellent history on blackface and how that parade used to look. The California police clips you played. Ross did 45 days to wait for footage of a police incident. That still makes no sense. The union wants the footage and recordings of all records and everything from the year 2000, from January 1st, before January 1st, to not be able to be pulled up. I mean, what are they hiding? This is California. We had the Rodney King trial. Policemen beating a black man on TV for the first time. The 1992 riots. The Furman tapes during the OJ trial. And the police force in Los Angeles and throughout California had done nothing to protect the black public from police abuse and misconduct. In fact, they made policies like the one that they discussed in that clips to make it easier for them to protect the police. With all that being said, it's just going to be even easier now because California has rolled out the predictive policing programs in several municipalities. And now the only excuse the police need for abusing or doing misconduct is to say the computer told them to do it. And that's it. And I'll read my line. Thank you, Gus.
Much obliged, Thomas, in New York, the D.A.R.E. program. It's great. Great point from Thomas in New York, because that had nothing to do with the stolen calculators and the riot squad going to storm grandmother's house for these calculators. Incidentally, I did make an error with the report on California, their new law about revealing these files, releasing information about police shootings and its other incidents as well, police shootings or anything sort of suspicious behavior. So that went into effect January 1, 2019. Prior to that, certain enforcement officials, I know in Sacramento specifically, they say, oh, okay, so we got to dump the footage that we have on hand. Okay, where's our shredder? That was the clip that I meant to include, because there was a different report that they talked about that and they included, oh yeah, and by the way, there are a number of police departments that have already started to shred these documents, so there will be fewer information to request. System of racism, white supremacy. Gotta always expect the tackiness. And I even thought the way that they discussed it in that report, they didn't specify. They just said that we made requests for stuff. It would have been appreciated if they could have stated explicitly, these are specific cases that we thought may be suspicious or deserved further review, not just stuff, if Black Lives Matter. Other folks that we've not heard from at all. Did we nab everybody? Anybody we missed completely?
May I be heard?
Greetings, caller in Florida.
Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I wanted to speak on, I think, is the young Black female, I believe, Jasmine Barnes. Is that the name?
Yes, Gus? Sir. Yes, sir.
And just the contempt for Black life, and when things happen to white children, someone spoke on earlier, like how they have a sense of urgency where they're able to find who committed the act of doing some kind of harm or murdering or something incorrect to a white person. They have the person in custody in a short period of time. And I was thinking about a couple years ago when I had called up and Gus, you had made a point about the, I think that the Black male name was James Chaney, and then he said the two white boys, because the explanation you gave was, you were saying like how it was, I think it was a documentary on how like they were going looking for the two white boys, and as they were looking in the area, they was finding Black people, like several Black bodies, and they just didn't care. Like, and they were just either finding them in the water or in the bushes, and is no care concern. So when you have that kind of system where they prioritizing the value of white life like that, I just wanted to mention that. Like, that was a great point that you made. I don't know if you remember it, but that was the explanation you had gave. There was another one with Kevin Hart. I know that's the entertainment area, but I think it was some confusion, I think, being put out there where I guess Ellen was, racist suspect Ellen was, I guess, saying that he should do the hosting for the award show. And I'm glad Nick Cannon mentioned the hypocrisy of the race soldier white women were making the same kind of comments that they call so-called homophobic, but they weren't punished, no, they weren't penalized for what they said. But that's to be expected, of course. And speaking of, I know these particular times where there's a lot of the allegations of sexual misconduct, there was a guy that was at Baylor, the college, and this is interesting because he was indicted on four charges of, I guess, I don't know if it was rape or something having to do with rape, but he didn't get any jail time. So it's just like Brock Turner, another white man who did not get punished with at least incarceration or whatever. And Ethan Couch, they made a term called affluenza. That sound like the term of the flu, influenza. Oh, well, you know, he's affluent. He has a lot of wealth and he's opulent and everything like that. So, you know, we can't punish him or anything, but really it's because he's white, because this white guy or young white person, he killed four people and they were white people and just didn't get any punishment. So being white in the system of white supremacy, definitely that is a continuous practice that definitely should be stopped. And that's the only thing I have right now. And thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. For sure, remember the logic about that's the way that I referenced the 1964 murder, white terrorist murders. I think that was referenced in the clip as well, but that's why I do it that way. James Chaney and those two white boys, that exactly, I mean, that's referenced many times as they were searching that summer of 64 and finding a variety of Negro corpses. And it was not, oh my goodness, and let's stop and do an idea. Let's, you know, get the riot gear and get the microscopes and fingerprint. It was, oh, did we find the white boys? No, just another Negro. It's not even the Negro that was, okay, next. Throw that one in the bucket with the net. That was the type of attitude. James Baldwin wrote about this, I think, in No Name in the Street. He wrote about this as they were finding Negro body after Negro body on their way to finding the two white boys and James Chaney. Did we miss anybody? Any folks that have a hand up that we've not heard from at all? Grant, we have like 20 minutes left in the broadcast. So if you have a hand up or think you might want to participate, do not wait till the last moment. Go ahead and get your hand up now. Mr. Steele, thank you for your patience, sir. Did you have an additional comment you wanted to share? Maybe we lost Mr. Steele. Are you there, Mr. Steele?
I'm eating almonds. Just a second.
He's got chicken nuggets. Those are not almonds. While we're waiting for Mr. Steele to finish, were any folks listening? Am I being nonsensical? I am a victim of racism. I have been greatly retarded. Anyone with the information that you've read about what happened to 7-year-old Jasmine Barnes, anyone of the opinion that, yes, if perhaps her mother had a firearm, that situation could have ended differently, where Jasmine Barnes would have still been alive, things would have been better?
High probability that
we'll get retired firefighter first.
Go ahead, man. Oh, I would say a high probability that the outcome would not be different. If anything, it probably could have caused more problems, you know, as far as that concerned. You really can't predict something like that particular type of crime taking place, especially if you are harmed in the process also. And like you said, at the same time, trying to operate a motor vehicle. It just, you know, very much complicated. It gets complicated as you add on a firearm in that particular case.
Much obliged. Was that Princess? Were you going to answer, ma'am?
Yeah, I was going to say that. And I don't know if I had misread, but earlier on when they released the composite sketch, they did indicate that the person was a bearded white man. So I was kind of thrown off when I saw the sketch. And I also was wondering, how did they obtain so much detail and from whom? I mean, I would assume the mother, but it just looked weird. And the fact that earlier on he was described as being a bearded white male. So, but apparently now I'm seeing that they said that they do have a suspect in custody, and from another post I was reading, somebody is saying it's a black male. I don't know. So we'll see.
Have you heard?
Mr. Steele.
Yes. Sorry about that earlier and everything. And no, I was not eating chicken nuggets. I really was eating some roasted almonds. But check this out. I always hear from people that it's ridiculous to think that the government or, white supremacists are running psychological operations on the minds of black people with their programming. But there was something that was very interesting that happened on New Year's. There was a comedian, Tiffany Haddish. There was footage of her doing a live performance. I think it was in Miami. And people were walking out of the performance. And, people were very displeased with what was going on there. And then there was links to video of her, bombing a performance at New Year's last year, and I think it was St. Louis. Now, I remember earlier last year, I believe it was last year, there was, I guess, a program going on whereby they were training people to say that this Tiffany Haddish person is funnier than another more well-known comedian by the name of Monique. And this was in the midst of some sort of dispute about pay rates for the rights to specials by Netflix. I think that was the company that was in question. And everybody was, it seemed like there was a refrain that said that this Tiffany Haddish person was funnier than Monique. And it just seemed like nobody had seen any of her shows. Nobody can tell me any of her funny lines or anything like that. And as a comedian, I'm just looking at this, and I'm, and I can see that there's definitely some sort of operation going on to make people say this. And then, I fast forward, I see these, the actual footage of her doing her set. And it seems like somebody who hasn't had practice doing long sets or featuring or, has a reservoir of material from which to draw from as a headliner. So it's just very surprising to me that people would argue that there aren't active psychological campaigns going on with this media programming that is in control by the white supremacists. And also, to a previous caller who was mentioning that black people or melanated people may react differently to drugs. I think that there may be some merit to that, and that's due to the presence of melanin in the skin and the organs. I think that there may be some credence to that. One of my roommates in college, I guess he was some sort of chemical sciences engineer or something like that. You mentioned something about melanin being more receptive to things like opiates, and that white supremacists in the past had noted this, and they would poison water supplies, knowing that melanated people are very sensitive to some of the substances that they have either engineered or that they have found and synthesized. So that's something that I've been very aware of. And recently, I got darker. And this is due to I was using some sort of peptide for reasons not related to getting darker. But I did some research and I found that this peptide is related to a product that was I guess synthesized by white supremacists called melanotan, and melanotan, it basically stimulates all of your melanin receptors throughout your body. I mean, like throughout your entire body, all of your melanin receptors are way more sensitive to UV light. I barely get exposure to UV light. I'm pretty much a shut-in.
for most of the day. And I have gotten notably darker. I'm notably darker. I mean, like, I was already pretty dark, but I'm significantly darker now. And I don't know how to, and I heard that the effects, can last up for months, and that afterwards,
30 seconds.
Even after it's worn off, you never go back to the way that your melanin receptors behaved before. So I don't know. I think I'm permanently darker. I don't know how to feel about that. I'm going to go ahead and mute my line.
Mm. Can I be heard? Thompson, New York. Folks in the background decided to get rowdy as soon as he wanted to speak. Think that may have happened. Did you need another second, Thomas in New York? Maybe so. Other folks have commentary that they wanted to share last few minutes.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm so sorry, Gus. No, I wanted to say something, and the sexual molestation, pedophilia, I think it's a direct result of, what happened to us during chattel slavery. If the men and the women were both getting raped, well, that will explain a lot. There was a white person by the name of Aleister Crowley, a white occultist. And he wrote about it and bragged about he wanted to be a god. He wanted to live forever. So what he did was he raped thousands of little boys. And he knew that he could live in their trauma, and they'll go on and do this to another little boy, because it happened to him. And, he did that in London. I think it's a direct correlation of passing on that trauma to someone else. I just find that it's very odd that Prince died. In my opinion, he was killed for, he went to court. He became the first artist that allowed all artists to be able to get their copyrights and publishing after 25 years from the record company. The judge, he won against Warner Brothers. In 2 years and 2 days to that day, he dies in his elevator. So 25 years, they can hold on to your copyrights and publishing, and now they have to give it back to you. They can't profit off of you anymore, and you get to keep whatever those royalties that come from that. And here it is, the 25th year since his first album, and they're coming after him. So I just find that to be very odd. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
No coincidences in the system of white supremacy. Other folks have commentary that they wanted to share.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. So I am also severely retarded. And we all are, but I didn't realize that she was in a moving vehicle when this happened, and that when I read it just again, that the person was behind her. I don't know that I would suggest shooting in a moving vehicle. I don't know that, I wouldn't, because you are in a box. But then the other thing is, I should say that with guns, you should have a lot of gun safety. You should use it defensively. You should still have a gun. Thank you.
For sure, Imhan DC. I have been greatly retarded myself, absolutely. Other folks have commentary that they wanted to share. Last few moments before we get ready to wrap things up. Everyone content?
Last thing, Gus, Texas this year, last year, also had a string of bombings of black people. I believe that was Waco, or
Austin.
Might have been Austin, Texas. I believe last year, Imhan DC alluded to the people that shot the black people at the Kroger's. That week, it was another incident where
That same incident, that guy first, he tried to get into a black church. Before he did that, yeah, people that were shot at a Waffle House that was strictly black, that wasn't mentioned as a race crime at all last year. So there was a lot of those type of incidents last year that I remember, more so than I remember in the previous years.
There were, I do remember the Austin bombings. I thought of that because it was also at the beginning of the year last year. I think it might have actually been February, but I mean, right at the beginning of the year with the bombings. And this is also in Texas. This is the shooting of Jasmine Barnes that was in Houston. So I did think of that immediately. So something to be mindful. And again, just watching how racists direct our attention. Be very suspicious when things come out and they can get lots and lots of black people to talk about one specific thing. Be mindful, especially when there are lots of other things. I mean, there's so many things happening in the system of racism, white supremacy, directly, indirectly related. Just be mindful about where, how we are using our time and energy. Did I hear somebody else? Anybody else have a comment they needed to get in?
Just heard through the local news down here in South Florida that an arrest has been made on that case.
Right. I read, after I heard Princess's comment earlier, I read and they said that there was a person of interest who was brought in to be questioned, but they were still gathering information. And the way that the article was written, they made it seem that this might not have even been a suspect per se. So more to come. We'll check more details and have more to discuss with this case. Be mindful. We have folks in the Texas area, so be mindful, be alert. Just all of us, the best you can do is just try and be as safe as you can in a system of terrorism. I guess that goes back to what I was saying about, I think Mr. Steele asked some weeks ago about how I felt in terms of being safe in a yoga class, because they just had a shooting at a yoga studio in Florida a few weeks back. And I'm, you know, generally the only black person in the class. And I said, this is the system of white supremacy. They do these, violence is every day worldwide. That's what the system of white supremacy is, in a variety of different forms, whether it's chemical, biological warfare and putting lead and whatever else in the water, or race soldiers, Dylan Roof and what happened with Jasmine Barnes. That's every day. You don't have to be in a yoga class or anywhere. They would just drive into the store and white terrorist. Anywho, if you have questions, comments, feel free, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. We should be here midweek. Check the Black Talk Radio Network page for updates to see when the next broadcast will be. We will post promptly, as well as posting updates on the COW's 10-year anniversary yoga retreat, which should be February 2019. With that, much obliged to all the folks who participated. I hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Again, sobriety would be best. Thomas in New York just said, it seems like there are more of these incidents happening, just random, unprovoked white terrorism, lethal white terrorism. If that's accurate, even if they're not more of these incidents, the fact that these incidents are happening, period, that would be a reason to be extremely alert when you go out. Maybe let's not be sober. Let's be checking around, mindful about what's happening. Is anybody following us? So many of these incidents, they happen so quickly, you never even know what happened. So just another reason, this is not a great environment. We're not having a party. Everybody is not our friend. We're in a system of racism, white supremacy. Our behavior should reflect that at all times. Concurrently, or with the same logic, in addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time that we go out in a vehicle, driver or passenger. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. With that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person
It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.